Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Welcome to Conversations in Black Mastery. I'm Veronica Conway, and I am so excited. We are here at the FraserNet 2008 Power Networking Conference, and we just heard a riveting, thought-provoking keynote speech from Dr. Jawanza Kunjufu, and we're excited just to take a few moments of his precious time and interview him about his mastery strategy. Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you very much, Veronica. Good to see you.
Good to see you. So the first thing that I want to ask you is, what is the thing that you're most proud of? What have you accomplished in all of the things that you've accomplished? You're a successful author, speaker. What are the things that you're most proud of, though?
I think probably if I had to reduce it down to one other than bringing people to Christ as a preacher,
yes,
would be the number of boys that I've mentored who've become classroom teachers, especially fourth grade classroom teachers. I believe the most critical grade for our students is fourth grade, and so many of our schools lack male teachers. And so to have spoken to a college, and there were males in that college who were so inspired by the presentation, they chose to become teachers, is very gratifying.
Oh, so you're really turning around black men in our community.
Sure.
That is so powerful. I would love to know, and for our audience, because part of the way that we are looking at this mastery conversation is we talk about, when did you first decide? In other words, oftentimes we're called and we get a vision for what we're, our purpose and what we're supposed to do. When did you first know, or what was the first message that you got that told you this was your life's work?
I was a junior at Morgan State, and the dormitory ran out of space for me on campus, and the Lord inspired me to go to the Yellow Pages and look under juvenile delinquent centers and convince the director and I'm a positive role model as a junior in college, and therefore room and board that I'll mentor and tutor the boys. And my bestseller is titled Countering the Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys.
Yes.
And I believe the genesis of that was in 1973 when I was on the third floor, the boys were on the first and second floor, and I didn't see any difference between them and myself other than they lacked parents, especially fathers, who gave them direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a junior, I realized that these boys need help, and then my passion started probably at that point.
That's so powerful. So for our audience, I want to point out some of the strategies that we're hearing. It's so important. If you want to bake a particular cake, right, you want to get the recipe, you want to get the ingredients, and you want to get the sequencing. So as he experienced the pain and loss in the black community, he got a message from God, really, to take action. And he went, yes.
When I was in college, a speaker also asked the question, why is it that our best black minds, mm-hmm, when they graduate, do not live, work, spend, volunteer, or invest in the black community? And that made so much sense to me, because how are we ever going to grow and develop,
yes,
if we graduate and then work for someone else?
That's right.
So it just made so much sense. So I made a vow at that point, when I graduate, I'm returning back to the community to produce me and give back to that community.
Mm, I love that. And so what are some of the, what motive, I mean, I know that transforming the lives of young black men motivates you. What are your other motivators? I mean, what, because you're doing God's work, and so getting up every day to face whatever you face and to see what you see, it takes such ongoing commitment and perseverance. What else motivates you besides seeing the transformation? What keeps you going? Because I think that if we want to be giving back to our community, I think we want to hear excellent role models of what actually sustains you and nourishes you and keeps you going.
Well, that's a tough question, because on the one hand, I would like to see more black businesses in our neighborhood.
Yes.
And, you know, with our economy being the way it is, I'm just concerned about companies like Walmart literally dominating, because price is such an issue for African Americans. It's like whoever has the lowest price gets
That's
the
right.
business.
That's right.
And, you know, in some neighborhoods, we don't have supermarkets. We talk about like food deserts. You know, I'm a health nut, I'm a vegetarian. And so it hurts me in neighborhoods where if you want an orange, an apple, carrot juice, good luck in some neighborhoods trying to find that.
That's right.
So it's good to see some neighborhoods are trying to do that. Like in my hometown, Chicago, Reverend Meeks at Salem Baptist Church, there were 42 liquor stores in a 50-block neighborhood. He worked, and we worked with him. There are now no liquor stores in that neighborhood.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So we see things like that take place.
Yes.
That's good.
Context of white supremacy. Justice, Gusty Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of racism, white supremacy. Today's date, Monday, July 21st, 2014. So I have been told. We should be back on Wednesday, same broadcast time. We will give further information. Should have a graduate student down at Duke University, North Carolina, Scotty Reed, Black Talk Radio Network. We'll be grand to have him on, hear some of his views on racism, as well as if you have been paying attention, just read a report where they, some of the black students organized, and they got the name of one of the dorms changed. It was named after a notorious white supremacist in North Carolina who also happened to be the governor about 100 years ago, and they named the dorm after him. That's why I said I don't get very worked up. Not, I think what they did is commendable. It's just I've seen where sometimes white people, we've had some on the program where they want me to get very excited because white people are changing the name of a school. I think down in Florida, earlier this year, they changed the name of a high school that was named after, purposely named after a Klan founder. I think it was Nathaniel Bedford Forrest. That was the name of the high school. And they did this purposely. It didn't end up this way accidentally, or this was not something that was just happenstance. This was done deliberately out of spite because white people were upset during the so-called civil rights movement with quote-unquote integration. They did not want these little black children going to school with their white children. So they purposely named the high school after a Klan member, but they changed the name. And I just said, there's so many things that are named after notorious racists that, you know, how many things are we going to change at any rate? But that should be Wednesday. We'll give more details a little later in the broadcast. Quickly, I will give a bit of gratitude. The folks who tuned in to the broadcast yesterday when we had Mr. Daryl Washington on the program to talk about workplace racism, I started off the program by giving out a bit of thanks to Mr. Al Osorio. He did a great interview with Mr. Washington to begin with, and then he helped coordinate and give me the contact information so that we could have him as a guest on the program. And he listened to the broadcast and had lots of pleasant things to say and shared the broadcast. Super nice. Definitely appreciate Mr. Osorio, as well as all of the good folks at San Francisco Bay View. Great journalism, much of it, most of it focused on racism, white supremacy, and things black people can and should be doing. Thanks again to San Francisco Bay View. That being said, our guest for today's broadcast. I think this was a recommendation from Mr. Universal Jones, unless I'm in error. I think it was he who said it would be grand to have her on the program. He thought she had a lot of constructive information. You can check out Justice Lab Radio as well, Mr. Universal Jones, his counter-racist effort, great material, Universal Jones, Justice Lab Radio. Our guest for today's broadcast thought it would be grand to have her on the program. We touched on many of the aspects of her work, not all, but some of the things that stuck out to me immediately. She talks about the importance of words. That's something that should be very familiar to anyone who listens to this broadcast, and just the words that you use, how they impact your thoughts and your actions, just the words that we use and frequently don't even give a lot of thought to in terms of words that we use to describe our goals, words we use to describe each other, words we use to talk about ourselves. One crucial aspect to her work, she is an author, a nationally, internationally recognized life coach. She is the daughter of a former Black Panther Party member. Fascinated to hear more details about that as we roll. And she is a mom. Always important to highlight that. Certified professional, co-active coach, the book that she co-authored, The African American Guide to Business and Personal Success. She also has a great manifesto called The Black Paper. You can actually access that online. You can just go to theblackpaper.com, theblackpaper.com. You have to get your email in there, but it is free. It's no shenanigans or anything. Just go to the website and you can get the free PDF to check it out. It has a lot of great information there as well. Just tons of great information. She has hours and hours, thousands of hours, successfully helping Black people, which is a part of her stated mission to aid Black people, being successful and accomplishing as much as they possibly can and really improving our quality of life. Always grand to have people with that as a stated objective, to help Black people achieve optimal, maximum success. Real pleasure to have her on the broadcast. You can visit her website, veronicaconway.com. Should be linked in the description. Again, it is veronicaconway.com. Joining us live from California, our guest, Miss Veronica Conway. Miss Conway, did we get you on?
Hi, good evening. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so honored to be here.
The pleasure is all ours. Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your afternoon with us. For folks who have not been to the website as of yet, or this is their first time hearing from you, anything that you think folks should know about you before we get started?
Gosh, that's a great question. Yeah, I think you gave out all the relevant information. You know, VeronicaConway.com, theblackpaper.com kind of gives a sense of what it, sort of some of the work that I do specifically around our psychology. Our issues. So yeah, I think that's you set it up beautifully, so thank you.
Right on. Make sure I get in as well. The audio clip you heard at the beginning, a great interview she conducted with one of our former guests, the legendary Dr. Jawanza Kanjufu. Great information. You only heard about half of the interview. You can check out the rest of it. It is online, but thought that was great material in there as well. For our listeners, they might not be familiar. You are a Black female. Is that correct?
Yes,
right.
I am.
Right on. This program, Context of White Supremacy, I have unfortunately concluded that we are in a global system of racism, white supremacy. I use those two terms as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that's an accurate definition?
I think that's a great definition. I think that's a great definition. Absolutely. I think it's clear. I think we imagined for a minute that we'd gotten past that. I would say that with the election of our president, that all of that, those tendencies that the dominant culture demonstrates, really reared their ugly head because for whatever reason that was a red flag and presented itself as a threat to them. So absolutely. And when you look at white supremacy, there is an ongoing and systemic, both, you know, physical warfare and psychological warfare that I think have been executed and implemented against all people of color. So I love your definition. It's very clear.
I know. I appreciate that. Before kind of get to your work, since you did mention our current president, he was been in the news for a lot of things recently. At least domestically today, he was in the news for signing legislation to aid LGBTQ individuals in the workplace. Did you see any of the reports about this legislation? Did you have any thoughts?
You know, it's funny. I've been traveling like crazy. I'm traveling this week. I just got back in town. I have not seen that. But I would say that, you know, one of the things that we have to get better at in our community is lobbying our president more effectively about the things that concern us. Right? If the LGBT community has done anything, they have organized themselves as a moneyed lobbying force, whatever their interests are. And I think that we have to do more of that in general.
I think at least for a time, black people were trying to be a bit more effective in terms of coordinating their efforts and trying to bring pressure where possible to bring about change, to make some positive improvements in the quality of lives for black people. I think during the 1960s and 70s, the
sure.
Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, I think, was an integral aspect of that effort.
Sure.
And even some of their members running for public office in California and various other places.
Sure.
Your father was a former member of the Black Panther Party. Can you talk about that and how that influenced your childhood experience?
Sure. So, you know, I was born, you know, the child of a former Black Panther. And so what that means is that before age 7, I, you know, we were basically on the run from the cops, from Bontelfro, from warring factions of the Black Panther and Communist Party. My dad was also a Marxist. So before the age of seven, I experienced death threats in my life. I witnessed police shootouts. I attended school under an alias. You know, I had to remember every day that my last name was Anderson and not Bowers, which is what it really was. And we were basically preparing for the revolution. And so my dad, you know, he was in the military at one point, and he was over in Marseille, France, and he came across his first red book, you know, Mao Zedong, and he came across France and known the wretched of the earth. And he thought that those principles applied to the condition of black people back in America. And so he came home, and, you know, I don't know if many people know this, but Omaha, Nebraska, where I'm from, was really quite a hotbed of political activities back in the 60s and 70s. Malcolm X was from Omaha. My dad was in that mix. Then we came out west, and he was the captain of the Richmond chapter of the Black Panther Party. But it was interesting because there'd been so much penetration from the police force and the spies and, you know, Fontelpro and all. There was very active campaigns to dismantle any sort of organized resistance that many times they would, you know, put plants inside those organizations and set people at war with each other. Very sneaky, very insidious. And so my dad was arrested when I just turned 7, and He was convicted of the murder of a park ranger. He's serving a life sentence to this day. So that's been 40 years he's been incarcerated. And we're in a fairly significant legal battle, and have been in a long-standing legal battle with the United States government and the court system about his release.
Wow. Almost speechless. I guess with your father, I'm glad you brought out COINTELPRO. I think that we have done many programs on that. People should be very well versed. That's why I really kind of had a yawn reaction to everything that people have talked about with Edward Snowden under racism, white supremacy. This is nothing new for what black people
have
experienced for decades.
That's true.
With your father's conviction, I know during that time, another aspect of what they did with COINTELPRO was getting a lot of black people arrested for just silly charges, particularly Black Panther Party members and others, but just a lot of fallacious charges, arrests, convictions. Did your father, do you think he participated in this crime, or did he actually did this? Is there any evidence either way?
Well, there's no physical evidence. There was never any physical evidence connecting him to the crime. Zero. So what they did was they got a couple of folks to turn state evidence against him. It was a testimony of a heroin addict and another person who was considered a snitch, and they got him to turn state evidence. So, you know, it's been part of the challenge has been is that even in looking at getting him out, and there's a whole kind of massive story about who's lobbied to keep him in. But even in the attempts to get him released, it's like, you know, I think there's been some thought about perhaps suing once he's out, but you got to get him out before you start doing that. But what it turns out that there ended up being, he was due to get out in 2004, and that's when he served under the old sentencing guidelines. There were, you know, if you got a life sentence. You would do about 30 years of good time. Like, there was a maximum expiration that was under the old guidelines. Now, they changed that, I would say, back in the 80s, maybe. They had the truth in sentencing laws, and the truth in sentencing laws said if you do the time, if you get convicted of the crime, then you do the time. So one of the perhaps intended or unintended consequences of that is that now if you've got guys that are going in for 10 years, and they're going to do 9, and there's no incentive for them to have good behavior, right? So you get a tougher criminal, or a tougher inmate, or a tougher, right? And my dad would talk about this a lot over the years in terms of what this is, a shift that was really happening that he's witnessed in terms of the demographics of the prison population and just the sheer numbers, because it certainly is a privatized industry. But with him, he was due to get out under the old sentencing guidelines. He was due to get out in 2004. And because he was convicted of the murder of a park ranger, and the Fraternal Order of Police is a very powerful lobbying body, I would say they're probably the most powerful lobbying body in the country. 312,000 cops, and they protect their own. And because they protect the politicians and they protect the governing forces, then they get what they want. And so when he was due to get out, the Fraternal Order of Police lobbied the U.S. Attorney General at the time, under Bush, Alberto Gonzalez, and illegally got his release, illegally blocked his release. So we were making a movie at the time, Daughter of a Panther, Revolution to Evolution, and that movie was about, you know, my daughter is a life of a panther, my life is a daughter of a panther, but also the work that I was doing in terms of founding the Black Coaches and, you know, going out into the world and taking this methodology of coaching into the world. But we were filming that movie. So we literally were flying down to film his release with the film crew. We had a PBS nominated documentary producer and director of sound. We were all flying down to film his release, and they blocked it in the 11th hour. We were literally at the airport, and we got a call saying he was not going to release it because the paternal order of police had intervened and had lobbied to not have his release. So that happened three times where he was due to get out, and they blocked it. When we started, when the attorneys started filing Freedom of Information Act stuff about, you know, this case, because they weren't really telling us why he couldn't be released. Then we found out that it was that all the folks that were on the opposing side were like Skull and Bones, you know, Bush cronies, you know. And so it sat on up until Gonzalez's desk for many, many years. And he'd already served his time under legal sentencing guidelines. But they really wanted to keep him in, and they still do, apparently.
Wow. Can't say that I am surprised, but, I mean, that is stagger. I mean, that right there goes to what I say with my definition and the core of it, dedication. 40 years mm-hmm. on, dedication. I guess.
Well, and understand, you know, that part of the, from my perspective, part of the dedication has to do with nullifying the daughters and sons of the alpha male black warriors. Because if we saw our parents go through so much suffering just to fight for freedom, and we see these horrible consequences, whether it was getting people hooked on drugs, which I've seen, it was getting people sent to prison or getting them killed, that part of the strategy, I believe, with that is to teach daughters and sons of revolutionaries, you will not do that.
Mm-hmm.
You will not follow in those footsteps, because if you do, we'll annihilate you. So I think that was very strategic to make a very clear example of the revolutionary.
Wow. I agree 1,000%. With that said, was there ever any point in your child, I mean, for your father to be in greater confinement in prison for almost 40 years, that's almost your entire life. Was there mm-hmm. ever any point, particularly in your childhood, where you were thinking, man, this, you know, revolutionary foolishness, forget all this. I don't want to do anything related to racism, and I wish my dad hadn't either. This is ridiculous. I'd just rather have my family and not have to go to school and go through all this. Did you ever have those thoughts?
Well, you know, so part of the reason that I do my work, you know, the work that I do, is because I had to heal myself, you know, physician heal myself.
Mm.
So, you know, I saw my dad live like a free man, and I saw brothers and sisters that were walking around living lives of incarceration. And I really began to ask the question at a very young age, what's the difference that makes the difference? Is freedom a function of your mindset, or is freedom a function of your circumstance? Because even though my dad was in prison, when we would go see him, he just felt free. He rallied a lot of support externally, you know, outside of prison. He tried to escape, and they dinged him for that. he did try to escape because he was like, not, he wasn't playing. He was at a lump hog. So that's where I really kind of formulated the idea, and I didn't even know what I meant by that, but I formulated the idea that freedom was really a decision that we could make. And if we made it with enough clarity and enough congruence and so as I got to college and I went to Berkeley, put myself to Berkeley, I saw, you know, I'm a sort of an anomaly. On the one hand, I'm very conscious firsthand and very direct of what it is that's been done to us and how systematic this form of annihilation is. I'm very sensitive, and I'm very sensitive to, because now what it is it's psychological warfare, right? It used to be warfare, the hand-to-hand combat, and it's not that, you know, they're, you know, police are militarized, it is warfare, but the bigger, the deeper piece that makes us so complacent has been psychological warfare. But at the same time, when I went to college at Berkeley, and I saw brothers and sisters running around from very middle class, you know, like, you know, homes and situations, I said, but yeah, but you're still in the first world. And if there's ever a place to be, have the power to form that change, it's really in your hands. And so, and that has to be a decision. So I sort of come down in the middle in a very strange way because of my circumstances, but because I also believe in the power of choice. I believe that the reason that the dominant culture is so threatened by us is because in all reality, we are the dominant culture. I mean, if you look at, you know, Frances Tress Bolling, the ICE papers, and she talks about fear of genetic annihilation, because that's really what it all comes down to, right? It really comes down, and let me say this, still be loved, let me say this, sounds a little crass, Osho, who's the Bhagwan Rajneesh, one of the things that he says that kind of mirrors what Frances Tress Bolling said is, it's all about keeping the black man from fucking. It really is about the fact that our genes are dominant, and that if we interact with them, that whiteness will cease to exist within a few generations. And so that reflexive, knee-jerk reaction that white folks have, and that instinct for what they're calling self-preservation, but ends up being like annihilation, I feel like it runs in their DNA. I really do. So, yeah.
Ashe, I agree wholeheartedly. Dr. Frances Cress Welding, she was just on the program last Sunday, frequently guest.
Love her work.
Lots of us do. Wish we could get more of her material out there so that more of us have a clear understanding of what's going on, what's happening, as she would say. Fascinating. And I also wanted to make sure I got in as well with you all being in California. We have listeners in the Richmond area. I suspect Ronald Reagan might also directly or indirectly could have had some involvement. I know he was a big time enemy of what the Panthers were doing in California, and
sure,
quite a few people he had direct,
sure,
indirect influence on what was going down there. I guess.
Well, but, you know, the original open carry was the Black Panthers, right?
Right.
So all this noise in the Tea Party about my rights, my Second Amendment rights, and my Second Amendment solutions, all that crap, right? But the reason that they initially took open carry off the books was because of the Panthers. They didn't want to see black men with guns, right, looking threatening, even though they weren't threatening them, they were being threatened. But that was the original open carry. I think it was Reagan that actually got that off the book, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you are correct, and I just make an effort to contrast. We talked about that, and contrasting that with current events with Cliven Bundy and his militia gang out in the
right
desert, that
right
that would not have been tolerated for 5 seconds if it had been black people, particularly black people if they were defying federal authorities who were saying, hey, you all are breaking the law. Not just
I know. It's crazy. I know.
Incredible. I reckon moving forward with your child, and that is just fascinating. I'm glad to hear that it seems like you and your dad have stayed in contact, even, you know, with him being incarcerated.
Yeah, I just spoke with him a couple of days ago. I went and saw him down in Atlanta, a couple of months ago. Yeah.
Wow. Outstanding. Glad to hear that. With you, right, you said at age 18, I experienced what I now call an identity trauma when I discovered that the
mm-hmm.
white mother who raised me for most of my life was not my biological mother. Can you give some detail on what transpired?
Yeah, sure. So I was 18 and I was like, you know, I was a fierce little knuckleheaded 18-year-old that thought she knew everything, because we do at 18, right? Like, and I was having an argument with my mother one day. My mother that raised me is white, even though it's interesting that she's Greek. So she used to try to pass for black in the Black Panther Party because there was such a backlash against black men intermarrying with white women. So we were having an argument one day, and I said in my little snot-nosed way, I said, you know, if you don't love me, then you should have never had me. And she said, I didn't. I'm not your biological mother. So I was pretty traumatized. And traumatized in the sense that there's a strange impact that happens to a person when everything that they thought was true, they realize, or big pieces of what they thought was true in terms of their identity, were not true. And so when I say identity trauma, what I mean is, who am I? They threw me into that existential question pretty early in life. Who am I really? Am I black? Am I mixed? Am I the daughter of a panther? Like, who am I? Really, who am I? And I think sometimes when we are in intense situations, which my most of my life, in my early life, been very intense, that it causes us to introspect and dig deeper as a way of surviving. In other words, I knew from looking around at, you know, my parents who did the best that they could, but I also was exposed to some pretty intense things just given my parents' position in the world. My mom tried to normalize our life as much as possible, and the reason that she didn't tell me about my biological mother is because I was so traumatized when we came out of my dad's trial. We were getting death threats at his trial. You know, I was having nightmares. You know, judges were calling, you know, attorneys, you know, prosecuting attorneys were calling me out in court, you know, and the child who's sitting in the front of this courtroom. I mean, there was just all this stuff, right? It was just really intense. And so when we got arrested, I went into a foster home with some very racist people who didn't even give me a comb to comb my hair. So because my mother wasn't my biological mother, and even though she'd married my dad, she hadn't legally adopted me, they couldn't release me to her when she got out of jail. She had to get my grandmother to come and release me. So release me to her. So she was doing the best that she could to protect me from more trauma. And she thought that by telling me about my, oh, and by the way, you've just gone through all this, little 7-year-old girl, and by the way, I'm not your mama. Right? So she didn't want to do that. And I understand in retrospect, I think it was hard for me at the time. But I found my biological mother, who's black, who I'm in communication with and contact with, and we found a way to sort of reconcile over the years. It's difficult initially because, you know, my position with all three of my parents, right, my stepmother technically, and then my biological mother and then my father, then, you know, could you take a little responsibility? And because I'm not going to be your parent, I get to be like, right, like you guys, because I've had to be an adult so much of my life because I was cast into very adult circumstances, right, and had to figure out ways to cope emotionally. So we had some difficulty, but I think we worked through it. And I think part of it is that I went through my own process of healing, which is really what led me to do the work that I do. You know, my I had a coach once that said, you know, you're the soul of black coaching. You've taken your own transformation, in other words, your own healing, and had a profound enough healing that you could actually model that in the world for other people. But doing that, you know, when I say identity trauma and deconstructing all of those places of, you know, who you think you are, I'm identified with black, I'm identified with being mixed, I'm identified with being the daughter of a panther, I'm identified with all of these roles and identities. I'm identified with all this trauma, right? When we identify with all of that stuff, at a certain point, we have to deconstruct that. Because some of the things that we may have adopted, and that we may have internalized over the years into our subconscious mind, are not useful to us in adulthood. The coping mechanisms, the compensating mechanisms, all the things that we do to survive traumatic experiences, as black people in America and on a colonized planet. Those may not get us the result that we want to get. So I think at a certain point, it's the job of every adult to go back in and deconstruct that which is untrue. And what I found over the years is the only way to really deconstruct that is to really go in at the subconscious level and deconstruct it there, because the subconscious runs all the action. And that's where we've been as black people the most deeply programmed and the most deeply hypnotized, is at the subconscious level. That's why so much of our behavior is unconscious to us. And that's at the individual level and sort of at the macro level. That's why I ended up doing the work, is because I had to go through a deconstruction process and throw off every single thing, really evaluate and examine every single thing that I believed, thought, you know, trusted, didn't trust, and really just get clear about the essence of who I was. So it was the most, one of the most painful things I ever went through, that identity crisis, but it was, but because I did the inner work around it, it was also one of the most empowering things I ever did. Because sometimes if life isn't really, really painful, you just kind of go along with the status quo and you tolerate low levels of pain. I was like the frog in the boiling water. I had to jump out. Right? I couldn't sit in the water and be boiled to death with low level pain. I had such intense pain, such intense sort of philosophical and emotional and personal things to uncover and to clarify for myself, that I had to go there. And it ended up being the path, you know, it ended up creating the journey that my life is and the work that I do.
Mm. Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest, Ms. Veronica Conway. Visit the website, www.veronicaconway.com. VeronicaConway.com. Folks that are listening in, if you all have questions, the number to dial, 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. If you have questions you would like to ask Ms. Conway, you talk about definitions, and I think this might tie in with the identity issues that you were having, particularly after you get this huge revelation at 18. What is your definition of black?
I don't know if it actually exists. I mean, it does for the purposes. See, black, I mean, all words are used to define meaning, to assign meanings to things. So if you think about you as anyone as a baby, right, we tend to have memory when we get language. We don't tend to remember much before we have language. And the reason that that's true is because language begins to give us a context to which to describe and assign meaning to things. Right, so that's a dog, and that's a cat, and that's a, you know, that's milk, that's mom. But usually, and I do a lot of hypnotic regression sometimes with clients, and oftentimes people will have a subconscious memory about something, but not necessarily a conscious one. And it usually, it's usually more of a subconscious memory that we can surface, but they're usually pre-verbal. So language just assigns meaning to everything. And so what's happened around the word black, it's been manipulated by the dominant culture to disempower and to do the psychological warfare that's been conducted against us. So, you know, you've heard, Toni Morrison talk about how, it used to be that it was just all Europeans identified by nationality. They didn't identify by white, but in order to gather people together and form a majority, when they left Europe and came over here, then they had to coalesce around whiteness. And so then by definition there was blackness, right? So, but they did that so that they could organize and coalesce around an identity so that they could whoop our asses, right? But before that, it was Italian and German, and right? So that was a construct that was created for the purposes of dominating us and getting the numbers. So that's the first thing. And then because if you just look at the basic dictionary definitions, there are so many negative connotations associated with the word black. I think that's by design. You know, a black mark on your credit record, you know, a black flag, everything that's negative has been connotated with the word black. And so I think that's been deliberate. So I'm not sure. So while, you know, while on the one hand I serve black people, I serve the African children of the diaspora. We use black as sort of shorthand, but really we have to understand that there's been a lot of subconscious meaning driven into that word on purpose, for the purposes of assigning a negative meaning to our very identity. And we've internalized that, by the way. We've internalized that negative definition into our identity. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is look around at us, at our communities, and know that we have internalized that.
When you are doing your thousands of hours of coaching with mm-hmm. black people, how do you see this this concept of blackness as something to be avoided or something horrific, always something bad associated with black? How does that manifest itself when you're doing your coaching?
Well, yeah, it can just pop up. So in other words, I worked with a man once where he was aspiring inside of his executive corporate job, right? Mm-hmm. And he would not compete. Whenever it would come time to compete with white boys, he would back down, shirk, like he would kind of fold. And it looked, so he was very high potential person, employee, but something happened. It's like a conditioned response mechanism. When I took him back and regressed him into what I'm going to call his first race wound, meaning the first time that he found out what it meant to be black as a negative experience, because we all have one. The first time when we really find out what it means to be black, that's usually a very visceral, you know, deep wounding experience. So when we took him back to that, and he wasn't even really conscious of it. He'd been a young boy in the Jim Crow South, and some white boys said to him, you know, you compete with us, boy, and we'll kill you.
Wow.
And they meant it. And so, unbeknownst to him, because he had an event that was made in a moment of trauma, a lot of emotion connected to it. In other words, we go along and we have all kinds of events, and we process some of them. We toss off some of them. We absorb into our subconscious. Your subconscious absorbs everything. But the things where you have the greatest emotional connection, where it's very visceral, where you feel afraid, you feel anger, fear, guilt, sadness. When you have those four emotions tied to it, then you form a belief, an identity. People are, I am, I better not. Because I'm a black man, I better not. Right? You form a core identity, and then you begin to filter the rest of your experience through the lens of that identity. So in his case, he filtered for, if I compete, it's all subconscious, if I compete, I'll die. And so this happened 40 years previously, this event. But as once we understood what that root cause event, we call it the gestalt, once we understand what that event is, and we can go back and then notice how that wasn't the only place, the most recent demonstration of how he was filtering, you know, he'd done it his whole life. Because once we get a significant emotional event kind of hardwired into our system, we will filter for that, whether it's true or untrue. Right, we'll filter for that truth. So if a young girl, you know, hears I'm ugly, and somebody tells her you're ugly, and she experiences it with a lot of charge, a lot of emotional charge, then she'll filter for ugly. I'm ugly. She'll just collect evidence or proof that she's ugly. There may be a lot of proof in the environment that she's not. There may be other proof that she's beautiful, but if she believes it, she won't filter for that. If he believes that he'll die if he competes, he'll filter for that, and that only. And usually, to do an intervention in that, you have to either go in and do the work that I do, which is like a radical intervention. I have to go in and unplug people from those root cause events, or you have to have another event that is so kind of earth-shattering, groundbreaking, reality shifting, right, that you don't believe that anymore. You know, so sometimes, like, if you have a baby, that's a pivotal event, right, and it shifts so many things that you've previously believed and take for granted, right? But there has to be some, usually a big event, usually something cataclysmic, or you have to go in and do an intervention on the belief. Because that's how you keep getting the results that you get. Like, he would have just kept filtering for, if I compete, I'll die, if I compete, I'll die, if I compete, I'll die. Once we went in and disconnected that, then he began to filter with, if I compete, I'll win. If I compete, I'll win. If I compete, I'll win. And then that became its own self-fulfilling prophecy and his new reality. So it comes up, not even because I go in necessarily and look for it, it comes up in the course of whatever the work is with the client and whatever's stopping them, right? And so I can just kind of, I don't know, I can smell limiting beliefs from a mile away. So we just kind of go. Well, we just kind of go in and dig that and unwind it, and then they end up performing differently.
Wow, you are a certified neuro-linguistic programming practitioner. What exactly does that mean? What do you do?
Yeah, so neuro-linguistic NLP. Neuro-linguistic. Neuro stands for neurology. Language. Linguistic stands for language. So a neurologist and a linguist got together, and they looked at how does language and neurology converge in the human experience and create reality. So for example, again, how do we assign meaning to things? Right, and so there's an impact. It's like when we believe a certain thing, it's like there's a certain set of strategies that we use to maintain that belief. So there's a strategy or a recipe for maintaining the belief, I'm ugly, or there's no good black men, or I'll never make money, or I'm not smart, or I'm not a good entrepreneur, or I'm not sexy, or because, you know, there's a certain set of things that we say to ourselves in our mind, you know, that self-talk. There's certain postures that we hold in our body and ways we use our physiology to create these states. There are things that we focus on that create these states. So what neuro-linguistic programming does is it goes in and looks in and really deconstructs the science of how you assign meaning, how you represent or represent reality to yourself. So all real change comes when we change how we represent reality to ourselves. So if we were to get a higher and more powerful vision of what's possible and then knock out all of the limitations out of our subconscious mind of stuff that makes it impossible, then we start to get really increasing and more powerful levels of performance. So when I first began this work, I knew that we didn't have 20 years to sit on a couch, even though we probably needed it. Right? Like, what's the fastest, most direct, like, how can I hijack somebody's mind for the good and get them rolling, right, towards, you know, higher and higher levels of performance? And that's why, you know, I call it black mastery. It's like the antidote to white supremacy. White supremacy is about having domination over others. Black mastery is about having power over the self. Because if we just got that, game over. Game over. But we don't have that.
Wow. With this, what you call like fastest way to hijacking the mind, we don't have 25 years to kind of have all
right.
of this take effect. How much of a role in terms of words, just getting people to monitor or in some cases change things that they're saying, and particularly the words that they use in their mind when they're talking to themselves or how they're talking about themselves and other black people?
Well, see, that's the thing is that there's, I mean, so and anyone who wants to check this out, the black paper talks about this, breaks it down in terms of the cycle of conditioning, right? So a belief leads to an attitude, leads to language, leads to action, gets a result, that gets reviewed and reinforced. So and that leads to the same cycle. So the thing is that I can always tell, I can always locate someone by their language. Whatever's coming out of their mouth is a deep reflection of the committee of voices that's inside of their head. Always. Without fail. Right? I say, you show me, you either have results or you have reasons. You either have the results that you want or you have a story about why you can't have it. And if I can look at the results and pretty much intuit the reasons, right? And it could be, again, race wounds. It could be class wounds. It could be, you know, wounds that we have had, even like, let's say, being in business, and then we struggle. I do a lot of business coaching. I coach a lot of entrepreneurs. And it's a big conversation, especially in our community, about money. Because we just haven't been given the financial education that we need, and we have a lot of limiting stories about money. Lots of them. Oh, my God. And many of those begin in the womb. So I've regressed people, sisters, brothers, back to, it's like when's the first time you realized that you had fear around, let's say, time or money? And if I regress them back on their timeline, it'll sometimes be, it sounds so weird, but my mom was pregnant with me, and that's where I decided. And usually if they go back and they ask their parents, was there an issue around time or an issue around scarcity of money back when you were pregnant with me? You know, and it's like, how did you know that? Well, because typically, a baby is awash in the vibrations of the mother. Even if the baby doesn't have the language to understand, the baby is still absorbing energetically all the things that are happening in the mom's environment. So if the mom is stressed or broke or afraid or there's no time, then all of that gets actually passed down vibrationally to the baby. And it shows up later when you're running a company. Right? I see it all the time. It shows up later when you're running a company. So you're bleeding your psychology all over the company. Right? So I think that entrepreneurship is a really powerful engine for Black self-sufficiency. We have got to get more of an entrepreneurial mindset. So I support folks in being able to do that. But so much of it all comes down to between ages 0 and 7 or around beliefs that get passed down intergenerationally. Because there are certain beliefs that get passed down intergenerationally to people in the DNA of their parents. So we go after that too, intergenerational belief set.
Wow. Fascinating. The black paper, I mentioned it before already. You can download it. It's free. The website, www.theblackpaper.com. Now, you have to put your email in, but it's no spam, it's no tricks or anything. Just put your email in. It'll send you a quick return link. Click it, and you can download the paper, or you can just read it online if you don't have the ability to download. From the black paper, you write, and this is just talking about beliefs. A belief is a feeling of certainty that something is true. Mm-hmm. Examples of beliefs are, people are blank, or life is blank. The beliefs that most powerfully dictate human performance are identity beliefs. I am blank, or because I am black, I can't blank. Beliefs are neither right or wrong. They simply yield results. The questions to ask are, is the belief useful? Does it create resourcefulness? A belief leads to an attitude. That process in terms of changing attitudes, can you kind of describe some of what you do, particularly with black people, and changing those attitudes that they might have about business or just being a black person?
Yeah. Well, an attitude is really, think about what an attitude is. An attitude is your self-talk or your expectation. So, if we say that somebody has a bad attitude, what are we really saying? They don't expect much, right? Kind of what we're saying. So beliefs are the root cause. Beliefs are the thing. I would say limiting beliefs and inner conflict, what we call part conflict. So with a limiting belief, you actually have to go back and have the person, again, in regression, a little bit hypnotic. And the reason that it's a little bit hypnotic is because you're being hypnotized all the time anyway. I don't know if you know, but, like, sitting in front of the TV by definition puts you into a light trance because your brain waves have to slow down enough to match what the frequency of the television. That's why it's such an effective hypnotic marketing machine, is that it literally, you go into trance the minute you sit in front of a TV. Right? And so when you talk about what trance is, what you're really saying is how many brain waves per second. So in a waking state, I might, you know, I might fire off 7 to 9 brain waves per second. Boom, 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 right? If I'm going into light trance, I might do 5 to 7, right? Or 1 to 3 brain waves per second. So the more you go towards sleep and relaxation, your brain waves slow down. So all you do in hypnosis or NLP is you just drop suggestions into the spaces in between the brain waves. So all trance is a deep state of relaxation. But the thing is that there's so much hypnosis going on that's been used against us, and so little that's been going on that's been for us. So when we talk about going in and having someone change their beliefs, we literally go back in and say, have them go back and re-decide. First, you got to get them kind of in a light trance. You got to get them relaxed so that they can actually access parts of their subconscious. Your subconscious records everything. But if we're in a big intense waking state, then we won't access it because we're too busy being on, right? So when you go into relaxation, then you can access more parts of your brain or parts of your subconscious. And so in that, we just surface what's going on in people's subconscious mind and then have them go back and find that root belief where they decided that they were ugly or decided they couldn't be an entrepreneur or decided to say, because they were black and dark skinned, that they couldn't, you know, whatever that is, have them redefine that. Get access to that event and then redefine that event. And then we have them redefine all of the subsequent events. So you really take people back in history and you have them examine those events, you kind of have them blow them out. When I say it creates like miraculous instantaneous change, you can shift stuff that has been plaguing people for years in a session, and it just kind of clears the path. It's very, very powerful. I've studied a lot of modalities over the years. I mean, tons and tons and tons of modalities, and this is a very powerful one.
Huh. Wow. Like you said, we didn't want this to be a 25-year thing. So if it's a black person, whether it's a black person saying, hey, we've always been poor, or a black person who says, hey, black people can't have million-dollar successful businesses, or at least I can't do that, or I'm a black person, so I don't think I'm attractive, whatever the case may be, what's mm-hmm. like the typical timetable in terms of getting to actually see some real results where they are no longer holding on to these beliefs?
Yeah, I would say it depends. I mean, usually it takes, I do what I call a breakthrough intensive with people sometimes, where we go in for a few sessions and we work on a single issue, right? Maybe it's an issue around money or an issue around attractiveness or an issue around business or an issue around the opposite sex, just whatever it is. And we can do a single issue and usually maybe 3 or 4 sessions. If people want sort of more sustainable change and they have big objectives, then it usually takes longer, and here's why. It's like I work with a client who, they came to me, he's like, I'm fat, I'm lonely, I'm not engaged in my business, I think I hate my business, I can't seem to get to the office, I can't do nothing, and I'm about to be broke, because I don't care right now. So in that case, we went in, and literally within 6 sessions, like 6 one-hour sessions, he had totally reversed all of that. He was working out. He was in his office. He was making money like crazy. So, I don't know. Every time he turned around, he was doing like $250,000, $500,000 deal. We just turned the whole thing around by going in and doing these kind of just busting down all these belief sets. These women, and we shifted it. And we shifted back, and he just, how he showed up was different. Right? And so then, because he had changed so dramatically in such a short period of time, his team, he had a small team, he's a brother, small team of like three people, couldn't keep up with how much business he was generating. They just couldn't keep up. So I had to go back. So then we had to go, I had to go do a team building and help them break through so that they could actually support what he was going out and generating in the world. So I say that to say that you can go in and do single issues, I would say, in between 4 and 6 sessions, 10 sessions. What people usually bring me on to do is they want kind of ongoing, sustainable, ongoing change. And what happens is, very interesting phenomena, especially in business, the more you, the more successful results you get in business, especially if they go fast, like my people tend to go really fast, they break through really fast, then the more quickly you're confronted with challenges that you've never faced before, right? Like all of a sudden you've kind of hit the threshold of what you know and how you know about how to function. And the fears that may come up at higher and higher levels of performance, more responsibility, more money, right? So what happens is you have to keep up-leveling on your way to ultimate success, because very often it's like, well, I'm great at doing a $10,000 deal, but if I've got to do a $100,000 deal, then I am going to choke, right? So you have to kind of go in and clear at the next level, and then when they're freed up and they get you up-level, people, you know, are clear at that next level, then they can operate at that level for a while. So a lot of my business clients are sort of long-term clients because I just keep supporting them and up-leveling and up-leveling and up-leveling, right, so that as they become more successful, that they their psychology can match it, because they've just never encountered the circumstance before. So they don't know how afraid they might be or how they might subconsciously self-sabotage their results or undermine it without even realizing it because they're afraid, right? Because the more success you get, the sneakier the saboteurs are. it gets sneakier, and it's a little more insidious, and you're moving fast, right? Because you're building a business, you can't really smell it on yourself, right? So it depends. It can, like I said, it can be like 4 to 6 sessions, but a lot of times folks work with me over the long term because they just want kind of ongoing up leveling in their business, so or their life. So that's sort of how it works.
Wow, that popped up. You just finished David Allen's Getting Things Done, and he mentioned that exact same concept where you start to be more efficient. Now you're getting a lot more things done, so you have to upgrade to now doing a lot more and getting a lot more stuff done, that same concept, once you start improving and making some successes. In your work, you also talk about, and I think this, again, going back to language and those beliefs and how beliefs that we have can be restricting, you encouraged or recommended that people not identify as a victim. You can say that you have been victimized, but you don't want to say that you are a victim. Why is that?
Well, and that's a great question. That's a great nuance that you're articulating. We have been victimized brutally by the dominant culture. And like you said, it's been quite systemic and deliberate. And yet, that's different than who we are. Our experience is different than who we actually are. And as long as we are identified as victims, as long as we think about ourselves to ourselves that way, then we have no, it's difficult to have hope to change it. Because it's not going to take a bunch of victims to change this, it's going to take a bunch of masters to change this. So we have to begin to live and speak the truth of ourselves into existence. It's just like one of the things that, you know, I was just on another radio show. It was this whole thing about how you know, black men call women bitches and how we celebrate that. And how, if the, you know, the younger you do that, the more the next generation is going to live into that reality. So how we speak to our children is so crucial. In fact, one of the things I often teach parents is you can have, when you're raising children, you can have embedded hypnotic commands in your language, and you can be hypnotizing them to the opposite of what you want them to do and not even realize it. So,
can you give us an example real quick on that?
So an example is, let me think of one. So it's like, you're so messy. You're always so messy. You never clean your room. I wish you would clean your room. You're so messy. So anytime you're saying you are, you don't, you should, you know, anytime you're giving a command, the subconscious mind doesn't process, or I wish you wouldn't, or how about this, I wish you wouldn't be so messy. The real command is be so messy. The subconscious mind doesn't process the not. So we have to be very mindful in our language to speak exactly what we want our children to live into, and not its opposite. And so just because we put a not somewhere in the sentence doesn't mean that we're not hypnotizing them with an embedded command. That's not what we want for them. So you actually, one of the things I've done with my kids is been very intentional and very conscious of the language that I speak to them and speaking into them what I want them to experience. So you know, I was on a radio show recently, and we were talking about, you know, bitch and hoe and all that, and how that's become a celebration in our culture to call our women that, and how devastating it is for our women and for our whole community. Because we've seen a generation that's begun to live into that identity, vis-a-vis BET and all of that stuff. So we got to be so mindful of the language that thoughts are things, words are things. So, yeah.
Abs, and folks who listen to this program know we spend a good deal of time talking about words and the importance of words, that it has a huge impact consciously, subconsciously, on how you think, how you behave, to just really be mindful of the words that you use and the words that other people around you are using, because it's been my observation, they tend to kind of leak. If you are around other people and the words that they're using, you can end up picking up those words and start using them too, and not even be aware that that is going on.
Sure.
With the term victim, I reference that all the time, saying victims of racism and pointing that out, and I get a ton of pushback from white people and non-white people. Now, the white people I kind of expected. I understand what's going on there, because I feel like for white people who are practicing racism, they do not want a clear articulation of what is happening. And we've even had white people on the program who have said, it makes me uncomfortable when you continue to reference yourself as a victim of white supremacy. And I can even say Dr. Robert Jensen, he's down at the University of Texas, Austin. And then he finally admitted, he said, you know, that is an accurate term, and it was bothering me because I am a white person, and just for white people, we do not like when black people are accurately articulating racism. And I've had that happen regularly with white people.
Because there's a reflexive defensiveness about what they're doing. And it's a crazy blind – I don't know if it's a blind spot or if it's just intent. I just think that they get this weird amnesia about their own nature. They get this very strange amnesia about their nature. But again, you can say we've been victims, but you can also say we've been victimized, right? Which is different, because it points the responsibility back to where it belongs, to the victimizer.
I say both on a regular basis.
Yeah.
With black, and most of the time, I would say most of the time, even when I hear white people or non-white people, when they say, "Oh my God, don't reference yourself as a victim," or "Don't call me a victim," it's not empowering, and blah blah blah, and all this other stuff. And my response is that, you know, I don't see large numbers of black people who think of themselves as victims of racism. For the most part, when I talk to black people, non-white people, the level of confusion about what's happening is so high.
It's true.
They will
it's
say,
true.
No, I'm not a victim
it's
of racism.
True.
White
it's
people
true.
Aren't doing anything to me, I don't have a problem. That's what I see all the time. And so
that's the psychological warfare. In other words, they've trained us to believe that it's our response to racism versus their proclivity for it.
Right, right, right. Absolutely, absolutely. For me, it is revealing truth, trying to get that clarity, because I feel like that's one of the major aspects of what you're talking about when you say that psychological warfare. I feel like a big product of that is to create confusion, so that you have all sorts of illogical nonsense behaviors, the calling black females bees and all the other stuff that we do that's not constructive, and just the variety of things that you see that are going on that are not leading us to being masters of anything, entrepreneurs or anything else. So I feel like that clarity is super important. But like, I do use victimized and victim equally. Again, prompt before I get my next question, make sure I'm not missing any callers. If y'all have any questions you want to get into Ms. Conway, visit the website. It is www.veronicaconway.com. If you want to dial in, if you have any questions, it is 760-569-7676. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you have any questions. I thought it was super important as well, the point you just brought up about what you say to your children, and you could be hypnotizing them or programming them to behave in a non-constructive manner when you're not even aware of it. Have you done any coaching work with children or very young people?
I haven't. I've been a single mom, and I got my kids $1 million in fancy private school education for $25,000.
Wow.
And so that was between that and being an entrepreneur, that was quite enough. And one of the ways that I did that is they went to school with the Redford grandkids and George Lucas's grandkids and, you know, the Schwab's grandkids, right? So they were being educated amongst the. And part of the reason that I did that was I figured if they were going to have to go to school and I wasn't going to homeschool, which I was not in a position to do, that I wanted them to be in an environment where they could go toe to toe with quote unquote best and brightest, most wealthy, most well educated, and have it not be a mystery. See, so often we look at the elite power structure and we think of them as having these mysterious superpowers because they've wreaked so much havoc. But I figure if you go to school with their children, it's not a mystery. They're not a mystery. And so my kids have kept a very black consciousness inside a very white school, right? My daughter stood up and gave a senior speech on white privilege.
Wow.
To her white privileged friends and got a first standing ovation. Right? So my kids are clear. and the other thing that I did as a single mom, when my children were applying to private high schools and colleges. My daughter was applying to she had 12 colleges to apply to. My son had 6 high schools to apply to. We were applying to 18 schools in 90 days. And applying for all of the financial aid, right, to support that, $400,000 for the two of them. So I built a team because I was tired and I was exhausted. And I said, where is the damn village? And I said to a friend of mine who was a geek, can we build a virtual village? Because I don't know how I'm going to get through this. And so we did that. We built a website. We built an online portal. We shared best practices. We had a team. We built a virtual village of experts, family members, loved ones all across the country that donated, supported, and that's how we did it. We built a village to do it. And so if anyone wants to see an example, my daughter's website is still up. If you go to jordan-conway.com, that's jordan-conway.com, that's the website that we use to get her into college. And to raise money and to, get all of her supplies for school. And we just did it as a team. And so that's an example of how to use social media and technology and community to push kids, you know, so that, again, my whole purpose was, you know, get if you're not going to homeschool, then give them the best education that money can buy, raise them with a black consciousness, and help them demystify these white folks. Because really, they're just sort of like, no big deal, Mom. Because at some point, you're going to have to go toe-to-toe with them. And so it's best that they not be a mystery to you. So.
Wow. Wow. I'm looking at the website right now, jordan-conway.com.
That's my girl. We had that was her public website, but we also had a private portal where we shared best practices and all the strategies for getting her into top schools. We did it all by, we had a, you know, met by conference call every 2 weeks. She led her team. You know, she raised money by doing little videos on YouTube and then saying, you know, donate to my PayPal campaign. She, you know, we did it. I mean,
wow.
This is before the era of like Indiegogo and all that stuff. So, yeah, we bootstrapped that way.
Wow. Wow. Did either of your children, did they have that moment, I think you said earlier, the racial wound where they realized, oh, man, there could be problems being in a system of white supremacy, being a black person?
You know, it's interesting. It's interesting. You know, I think it snuck up on my kids. And also because, you know, in their early years, as they were going to school with all these little white, rich white kids and, you know, going to, you know, houses where there's five nannies and fine art and all of that, I tried to not racialize their experience. I just kind of let them have their experience. The schools that I sent them to were very conscious. They were they actually had great cultural education, really global cultural education. It was, you know, I mean, Africa and Marseille and Mali, and I mean, it was very progressive in that sense. But I tried to not influence it, but they came back strong with their blackness, right? Because I didn't want to push it. I just wanted them to experience it, and they came back strong with their blackness, and then I just supported it. they began to say, you know, what is going on with white people? Like, really? Like, what is this entitlement crap? Like, what is that, right? They came back to me with it. So then we had those conversations because it was organic and not me trying to impose upon them or pre-program them to have a certain kind of an experience around that, right? By let them generate that conversation themselves.
Wow. That is fascinating. That is fascinating. I know that comes up a lot in terms of talking about racism. I guess, what age were they, if you recall, what age were they when they came back and saying, you know, what is up with this?
I think it happened pretty early, say like third, fourth grade.
Wow.
They had a real consciousness around, you know, around that. And again, this school that they went to, were they, you know, there was quite a bit of, I'm going to say probably some of the most progressive education around culture that you can find, and that's not in an all-black, you know, school. They just kind of approached it as like the children were global leaders, and so they approached culture. You know, so they had a lot of conversations about culture, but yeah, they got it early on. They got it early on. I mean, and you know. And then I let them drive that conversation. But in those environments, what you also have to do, and I've helped a lot of parents, by the way, get their kids, or I've had the conversation to, you know, support parents in getting their kids if they want to choose sort of this private independent school Ivy League route and get it funded. You know, I've always said, you know, that one of the things that people don't realize is that these schools have a mandate to have diverse student population. They have a diversity mandate. And they're looking for qualified students of color quite often that can taste inside of those environments. And so once you can demonstrate your ability to pace inside those environments, they go to a great length to recruit you and to keep you there. And it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So once a lot of folks just avoid it because, you know, K through 8, $25,000, and high school is $40,000 a year, and college is like $70,000 a year, right? And so people avoid it because they avoid it because they don't think they can afford it. But the truth is that the school will typically meet, depends on the school, but they will meet 100% of demonstrated financial need. Now, your job in that case is to keep the child very buoyant and grounded in their Black identity and grounded in themselves and who they are, and to support that. Because there, you know, there's just as many challenges around class in those environments as anything, because money is such a big deal in those environments. But, you know, if you, and the quality and the access to resources is quite profound, and you can have, I mean, you know, it's not always a perfect experience, but if that is an intention, I would say that more people need to understand that you can do that and not pay for it than you think, if that's one of your intentions. People miss this all the time. They just don't. They just assume that the sticker price is the sticker price, and it's not.
Right. There are tons of scholarships and financial aid, and there are a lot of options to help out in that. Plus, with the crowdsourcing, crowdfunding opportunities that are available now, that's a whole other avenue that wasn't available up until very recently for a lot of people.
Yeah, we didn't. I didn't have that. That didn't exist when I was putting my kids through at all. So yeah. There's a lot of resources. Until we can seize back the reins of educating our children in an effective way, because really in most of the public school system, unless you've got very progressive teachers, our children are being miseducated and being trained into an underperforming identity. That's just the truth. Because until such time as we can take that back with some power, I was like, what's the next best thing? If I can't homeschool, because I'm the single mama, I was the breadwinner, I was the provider. And I'm an entrepreneur, you know, so how do I do this? And so I just allowed the answers to reveal themselves to me about how to do it.
What do you share? Because you said that you work with parents and the importance, if you're going to have your child in that kind of Ivy League route, the importance of keeping your child grounded about what it means to be a Black person and the reality of the system of racism. What do you encourage or suggest that parents do to help with that process?
Well, again, it's a frame for communication about what's going on. And so it's getting very curious about the child's experience and listening, you know, not with an agenda or not even with judgment. Because, you know, if they weren't experiencing that disconnect, I was not going to try to shove it down their throat and say, you know, you've got to work 10 times as hard as a white person and do all that storyline, even if it's true. I wanted to let them come to it organically. I think that's very important, is to be somewhat neutral in service of their discovery and create an open framework for them to communicate to with you, but you can't be agendaed, especially when they're young. I think an agenda squashes it. Right? So creating a good open space for communicating about all things, not just race, sex, drugs, rock and roll, right? Like communicating about all things, creating a safe space so that your kids know that they can come to you and that you are a true confidant and that you won't judge them, but you will support them, right? Because if you set up that tone, see, my kids never had much to rebel against, because what I did was I gave them a lane. Right? And they were very busy inside that lane. They had to go to school, and they had to be high-performing students. It was very competitive in these schools. Right? They had a ton of activities. Right? They had a lane, and they went back and forth in that lane. And because those schools are so well-resourced, they get a lot of choices inside of that lane. So, great, you want to learn Lego engineering after school? Great, we've got that class. You want to learn CD production after school in third grade? Great, we've got that class, right? Because that's what happens in these well-resourced schools. There's a ton of choice, and you almost don't have to do enrichment as a parent. I mean, you do your cultural enrichment, maybe your spiritual enrichment, but from an activity standpoint, there's so much enrichment baked into those environments. So if your kids have a lot of choices inside the lane that they're in, they never really realize that the lane's there, so they never have anything to rebel against because they're choosing. So I never went through the tough teenage years of rebellion because there was nothing to rebel against. And by the time they got old enough to know that there was a lane, they were already conditioned inside of it. But so much of it was stuff that was of their own choosing. In other words, they got to choose and formulate their ideas and their identity and what they wanted and what they loved and what they, right, inside of this space. And they were very busy doing that. So when you do, when you set it up that way, then you don't create resistance in your child. Right? That your children resist when you dictate. Right? So that's about race, it's about sex, it's about anything that's meaningful that you need to be in communication with the kids about. If you dictate, then they rebel and resist. If you allow, then they feel seen, met, and heard, and will confide in you. Or it's not confide isn't even really the word. They just, there's trust. Because you're actually validating who they are and their choices inside of the lane, inside of a construct. So that's, I hope that makes sense.
It does. It does make sense. I've heard that as well in terms of making sure you're not trying to force a certain way of thinking on your child too early. And I think even Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., I've heard him say that as well in terms of talking to racism with your child. His recommendation is you talk to them when they present it as a problem or when they ask questions, even if it's not as a problem, but when they begin asking questions about it, that's the time to talk about it. I definitely wanted to make sure that I asked, we have a lot of Black people, whether they're guests or callers, we're talking about their careers and whether they are very successful or whether they're having a lot of difficulties. Stress comes up all the time in terms of just navigating and being a Black person and just having a lot of trauma that they're dealing with. Do you have any recommendations that you give out for your clients in terms of how to manage stress?
Well, you know, I'm always going to be the go-to girl for getting rid of the underlying beliefs that cause the stress, right? So, you know, I mean, and I'm not trying to sell anything here, but the Black Mastery Program, you know, if you go to blackmastery.com, that is something that goes after underlying beliefs about what it means to be Black, about what it means disempowered. I always believe in going after that because then you're not putting a Band-Aid on it. Mm-hmm. You're actually going in and solving it at the root. So that's something that I built so that we could, so that people would have an easy way to access that work and not a lot of money. You know what I mean? So I think first things first, you got to get all within your capacity to go after it at the root, because when you do that, then it goes away forever and you're not inside of a Band-Aid. So there's that. I mean, I think that, you know, I've certainly coached a lot of brothers in this workplace. let me say this and still be loved. I think that increasingly there's just less and less and less available for us in the corporate marketplace. And as long as we're dependent on somebody else for our livelihood, then we are going to be under a constant effect of stress. Because here's what's happening. I mean, I'm involved with a lot of national conferences. Like, I'm taking a team of coaches to the National Urban League next week, and I just came from the Power Networking Conference. That's where we recorded that interview a few years ago. And one of the things that I've witnessed happening over the years is, just like my father witnessed, you know, more Black men going to prison for longer, tougher sentences. Like, he's witnessed that whole transformation inside the prison industrial complex. One thing that I've witnessed as an observer of sort of the Black corporate space is that there's fewer and fewer of those jobs for us.
Mm-hmm.
So even my friend's conference, one of my client's conferences, he used to get a lot of Black dollars for Black sponsorship. So he had, you know, a person sort of connected and you know, ExxonMobil or whatever the company was. He'd have connections, diversity officers there, whose interest it was in to allocate money for Black causes and to advocate, you know, for diversity initiatives inside those organizations. Well, they are going away. That's just going away. There's less and less advocacy for us as black people inside these organizations. And there, as they downsize and restructure and still get quote-unquote lean and mean, there's just less and less opportunity for us to have jobs and to have any protection inside these jobs. It just doesn't exist anymore. So I just believe in my soul that we have got to be entrepreneurial. And believe me, being an entrepreneur has its own stresses, because you got to eat what you kill, right? You got to feed your family, right? But the thing is it creates a level of self-sufficiency that I think we have got to begin to move towards. We just have to do it, because they're not going to—they're going to keep kicking our butts at these jobs. They're just gonna. They're gonna try to hire their own, because they sort of made the decision. Well, Obama was elected. That's it. We've done enough for y'all. So right. I mean, that's just the get down. So understanding that, we have to understand that in order to be so entrepreneurship is the way to self sufficiency. If there's 1.9 million black solopreneurs in the United States. So I'm a solopreneur. I have a company, and I have a couple of roles that I subcontract in my business, but I'm basically a solopreneur. If every black entrepreneur could hire another black person, we would eradicate black unemployment. Just like that. It'd be over. Right? But we don't think like that. So we've got to build the capacity to take back, take over the industries that have been taken from us, for example, the beauty industrial complex and the black beauty supply. Like, we need to take that back. It's a $7 billion a year industry, right? We need to go, it's entrepreneurship. And I know that, you know, that we've had instances where our entrepreneurial efforts have been sort of burned to the ground, but I think that at this point, the stress comes from the dependence and the uncertainty of counting on the goodwill of somebody that you're dependent on for a paycheck who does not have your interests at heart. That in and of itself is stressful.
Amen.
So that's stressful. So at some point, rather than say that's stressful, we got to say I'm changing that. And I'll do whatever it takes to change it. Because believe me, every other culture, we're a $1.1 trillion economy. We're a bigger economy in terms of our collective income than most of the countries in the world. But we spend all of our money because other cultures have figured out how to sell and market to us, and we don't know how to sell and market to each other and build the internal capacity that comes from entrepreneurship. And I know why. I mean, the way it's been yanked from, they've tried to torch it, but there's never a better time, I think, given the advent of social media, given the increasing level of access that we have to be able to, hit send and reach a bunch of people and put up a YouTube video and reach a bunch of people. There's just so much more opportunity that is out of anyone's control that we can leverage and to begin to build self-sufficiency. I think that stress comes from not being self-sufficient. That's a long answer to your question. I gotta build me a little soapbox and get on it. I'm going to get some wood and a little hammer. I'm going to build me a soapbox.
I appreciate the thoroughness. That does make a lot of sense, though. I think for a lot of people, just being in that environment, that's what they have attested to, the stress of it all.
It's toxic and crazy. Yes.
Absolutely.
So stop subjecting yourself to that. Get out. Figure out how to get out. I mean, there's just so many ways to start businesses these days. Really, there's so many ways to start businesses these days. Get out of that grind, because there's just that's not going anywhere in this country.
Mm. You mentioned this. Really, you already have your soapbox. You can visit the website for www.blackmastery.com, where you can get CD set, short book. It's not a whole lot to read. When you have audio as well, that will help folks get to that state. That's what you said. This will overcome the system of white supremacy where black people become masters of self. Before I get like the pitch to what folks get with this package, you have at the top of the website, once people go there, it says, a black man just became the leader of the free world again. What's holding you back? We wanted it, and now we got it. November 4th, 2008, a black man won the most influential seat on the planet, and until now, that seat has only been white. Do you know what this means? I can no longer say I can't because I'm black. Over 50% of white America voted for our black president. Do you know what that means? You seriously have to question your beliefs about white folks holding you back. Does that still hold true, 2014, what you made in that statement, what you said?
It does. Because, see, here's the thing, and maybe this is just my crazy, wacky perspective. I see what has been happening. I see their reaction as being one of fear, not one of power. That reaction that they're having, that the amplifying of racism in this day and age, is out of fear, not power. In other words, that you know, this is a race of demographics at this point. It's fear of a black and brown planet, right? So I think that that's the perfect opportunity for us to assert and assume our own power to ourselves, with ourselves, and to each other. We have to do that. We have to quit letting them dictate the narrative and being a reaction to that narrative. Because that narrative that they're ginning up is only one of fear, even though they won't tell you that. So what they position it as is like amnesia. I don't understand what you're complaining about. I don't understand what you're talking about. This is selective amnesia. But really, it's fear. So we got to get that and see past our own reaction. And believe me, I understand why we get triggered and why we get like, ugh. Because it's horrifying to see this raise its head over and over and over again. It's like, really, white people? Are you sure? Really? But it really is that. It really is their fear. So, but rather than spend our energy being a reaction to that, we have to begin to spend our energy being and put our attention and our focus on building our own independence and self-sufficiency in a way where what they do doesn't matter anymore. So that what they do doesn't matter. I'm a big fan of Claude Anderson, Powernomics, right? Like, he wrote that 20 years ago. It still applies today. Of the pillars that you have to build to build a real economy. We can still do that. We have an economy. We have a $1.1 trillion economy. But to your point, we're so confused and we've been so brainwashed and so hypnotized and so under such psychological warfare. So at some point, we have to decide that no matter what they do, we are going to let our internal compass direct our future, not some response to some narrative that they put out for us. So it is true.
What you have on the website, and again, folks can check it out at www.blackmastery.com, that this program that you offer, that this will help folks be more in tune with that internal compass and not paying attention to whatever white people are doing with regards to practicing racism. What exactly will be most helpful in this program?
So it's a downloadable product. I used to have it on CDs, but that was just too much logistics stuff. So it's a downloadable thing. And really, it just goes. It has some visualizations that go after your inner compass about. I think that black identity piece is so. You know, we said earlier, if I subconsciously connote black with something negative, and I may not even know that I do it. Believe me, I've talked to plenty of conscious black folks that don't know that they're doing this until they get into these and until they get this intervention, and then they go, "Oh my, I didn't know I thought that." Right, and that's true for me too. I didn't know that I thought that. I know that, for example, when I was releasing the Black Mastery Program, I was procrastinating about releasing it in the black paper. This is like 5 years ago. I was procrastinating, and I couldn't figure out why I was procrastinating. But if you're procrastinating about something, it's because you're usually afraid of something, right? So when I really began to investigate deeply, what I really came to understand about my own thought process is that I subconsciously believe that if I released this work, that they would come after me and incarcerate me like they did my dad or kill me. That's what I believe. And so, right, so you either have results or you have reasons. I was either going to get the result of releasing this, or I was going to have a bunch, I was going to be creeping around, procrastinating, not quite knowing why. But that was the driver. And that was from a set of traumatic events and experiences that happened to me between the ages of 0 and 7. Right? It's little threads of stuff, right, that was stopping me in my tracks. So then I went and listened to the Black Magic Program to resolve that so that I could release it. If that makes any sense at all, I had to listen to my own stuff so that I could actually release the work into the world and clear the limiting belief called, they're going to come and kill me if I speak my truth into the world. So that's what it does. It's 20-minute visualizations. You listen to them with headphones. They're hypnotic inductions. You deal with, you know, your limiting belief about what it means to be black. You deal with what any limiting beliefs that you have about what it means to be black or anything else. So we deal with that. It's like 20-minute visualizations. We help you vision a plan for the future, like a plan, and really install that in your nervous system so that you can't stop moving towards it. You know, we help you with, there's a thing about procrastination you can listen to 9 minutes a day, and you won't procrastinate that day. You know, we help you develop a vision and a plan and daily habits. So it's just kind of a do-it-yourself, step-by-step program that kind of walks you through the four things of what it means to achieve anything. But it's really the first of its kind because it's the first one that takes on a limited black identity directly. And because I believe, you know, how we identify with ourselves is the first, the identity beliefs are the most crucial. I deal with black first. But you can always go back. I have people that go back and listen to it every day. And they do black, limiting beliefs about black, limiting beliefs about I can't work out, limiting beliefs about I can't be in business, limiting beliefs about whatever it is, right? And you can use it over and over again to kind of annihilate those things. So people go back and they use it as like a working, as a way to just get through different issues, procrastination, planning, visioning, goal setting, limiting beliefs, inner conflicts. So it's really, you know, I put my foot in that one. It's the kind of my baby. And I designed it because people, my clients kept saying, I just want to put you in my back pocket. How can I put you in my back pocket and carry you around with me? Like, you know, so I developed, I said, okay, how do I do that? So that's my love letter to the black community to help them at that first layer of really shifting those identity beliefs.
What's one of the things in your program that is a recommendation that black people are doing on a daily basis to help them towards black mastery?
Well, I think it's so this is so way you think about this in terms of the way the brain works is you go from the very general to the very specific, right? So the reason we don't often have a true vision that's like lit up in our nervous system that we can't stop moving towards, the reason we don't have that is because we have all these limiting beliefs that stop, intrude, and interrupt that before we even get to having the vision, right? So we go in and you clear the limiting beliefs, then vision can actually pop out. Then once you kind of get that meta vision, like that bigger picture, it's kind of right brain, it's kind of fuzzy, then you get a sense of what where you want to go and what, you know, and you get called to go in whatever direction. And then you begin to drill down and you begin to break that down into smaller steps. So what's the 6-month vision? What's the 3-month vision? And then you take that and break it down into daily habits. So that really depends on what you want. In other words, what you decide to dial in as a daily practice really is a function of what's your larger overall vision? Because here's what I think. I think that if any black person is on fire, right, really, you know, empowered, on fire in their soul, they know what they want and they know how to get it and they're on fire to having it and there's, you know, there's no limiting beliefs about having it, I think that that is mastery. We rarely do that, but we really get mastery over our lives, and we really go for what is the most potent, powerful part of ourselves. Because what happens is when you get lit up and your nervous system gets activated with what you're meant to do with your purpose, I actually have a visualization in there about helping you define your purpose. When you're called to that, that is mastery. And the more you do that, the more you can empower other people. In other words, if I was sitting in a cube, if I was a cube dweller, cubicle dweller like I was 20 years ago, right, laboring it away at a job that I hated, then I would not, if I hadn't taken the risk to be an entrepreneur and to sustain that, to build a Black Coaches organization, if I hadn't done that, then I couldn't be with you and impact you in the way that I do. So at some point, you have to make a choice to follow that calling. So if we were all doing that, game over. If all Black people were doing that, then game over.
Visit the website. Black Mastery, she says, this is the solution to white supremacy, Black Mastery of Self. You can visit the website to check out that program and get a copy downloadable. It's at www.blackmastery.com. You can visit her personal website at veronicaconway.com. We had a caller who had a question for the other folks. If you have a question, do not meander until the last minute. Get your hand up. For the person dialing in at 3231, did you have a question for Ms. Conway?
Hi there, Ms. Conway, and hello, guests.
Hi.
I just wanted to say thank you so much for coming on. Like, this has been really, really interesting to hear. I didn't think I'd get up so soon. I thought somebody would come before me for sure, but... I guess, I can't think of a good question. Do you mind if I just like make a quick comment and just say
sure,
that,
absolutely. Sure.
Okay, great. First off, I wish I could carry you in my back pocket too. And then, but also,
thank
I was going to say
that.
Yeah, I think we all grow up, to a degree with that debilitating fear of what might be. And then, and I think you've already touched on this. I realize now. But it's just to do with the way we grow up, and I think one example I can give is even like if you grow up and you're going to public school and you're watching The Roots, for example, or something, you're getting that programming at a very early age where Black men and women are being whipped on screen and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that reinforces that in our psyches and our subconsciouses that's who we are.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And then we filter ourselves. I feel like I'm the same way where I just like had troubles competing a lot of the times. And I'm not entirely sure where my moment is, but thank you so much for coming on.
Sure. You're welcome. It's my honor. Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate that, Klondike Mike. The person that dialed in, Mr. Demery 4, your line should be open. Mr. Demery 4.
Yes, can I hear?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Greetings, Ms. Conway, and greetings, Mr. Renegade. I was debating on whether to call in. I think that your information is constructive. But I just, have this burning desire to ask this question. And first I'd like to say that you mentioned that you was not raised by your biological mother but a stepmother, and that she raised you white. Did you say that?
No, she raised me. She raised me in Oakland, in the hood. She was white, but she raised me in Oakland.
Oh, okay. Well, my question is, do you have any white friends? And if you do, could you relate to us how you relate to them? And if you don't, why not?
Yeah, no, I do have a few white friends. I don't even have, I wouldn't even say I have a lot of friends, because I think as I've gotten older, I have narrowed the people that I choose to spend my time with. I relate to folks based on their heart and how they show up with me. But I also, the few white friends that I have, typically don't have that reflexive defensiveness around white privilege. Like, they really get it. Like, yeah. Right? They really get it about how things are, and there's no defensiveness about that. So that, to me, is a criteria. When people have that reflexive defensiveness, and I don't even really deal with it much. Does that answer the question?
That answers my question. Thank you very much, and thanks for dropping by.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Gus.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Appreciate it. Yeah, folks, you had a question for Ms. Conway. You should get your hand up in the next minute or so. Do not be lollygagging today. Make sure I did not forget to make sure I get my list of questions back up. My question list disappeared. Okay. Make sure I get in as well. It's on your website that you have thousands of hours accumulated in terms of working specifically with Black people, and that's a part of your mission statement to help Black people improve their quality of life. It's been my experience, other individuals who set out and said that our goal specifically, or even if it's an individual, is to help Black people, that white people tend to make it very difficult for them. Have there been any obstacles, or has it at any point been any efforts to kind of sabotage your work since you're trying to help other Black people out?
You know, it's been interesting. One of the projects that I did was I trained financial coaches. They were really case managers in the nonprofit world. So there's a foundation. There are foundations out there that work with low-income communities around financial literacy. Because one of the things that has to really happen in the toughest urban communities in America is that this is pre-2008, this is pre-crash, right? When more people got poor, right, post-2008. But this is pre-2008. We were going around and we were training case managers and social workers that were helping people that were coming out of the toughest cities in America, coming out of prison, coming off welfare, coming, mandatory into these programs, and they needed a more empowered way to get them to have them perform inside of their own lives, right, inside of their own financial lives, inside of their relationships, inside of having a job, right, and how to do that. And so we train them in financial coaching as opposed to financial case managing. Financial coaching is very visionary, and that raises the expectation of performance, whereas most case management and social work can be very it's deficit-based. What have you done wrong? You take an inventory of what you've done wrong, and it creates people being more identified with that. We did some very, very important work. We trained probably 300 case managers all over the country in financial coaching. It totally changed the entire game in the foundation community, meaning all the foundations came to the table, and because coaching was really new back then, and really, because they did evaluation on us, they did all the stuff. So it's interesting. I had a brother that brought me in, and we started rolling out. We, designed the pilot. We rolled it out. We trained all across the country. And then at a certain point when he left, I had folks say, well, you got to do that, for a tenth of the price. And so at some point, they kind of undermined that and gave it, and basically somebody's kind of stole the program from me, and is now doing that work in the nonprofit world and in the foundation world. But, we did it. Sometimes you have to learn what your role is. In other words, a lot of times, one of the identities that I have is as a rainmaker and a person who kicks doors down and sets down imprints in places where there weren't any before. So there wasn't coaching in the Black community until we went and did it. There wasn't coaching in the philanthropic community serving low-income folks with financial literacy until we went and did it, right? And so sometimes you have to know your role. So when the sea changes, right? Even though I was mad, I just kind of walked away from it because I realized that sometimes my role is to put down an imprint, and that's what you do when you kind of set trends and you lead trends as opposed to, and you have a vision that you're answering to that nobody else can see, then somebody's going to try to come along and, you know, undercut you or undermine you or outprice you or whatever, and that's just the nature of business. So, yeah, would I say some of it was racially motivated? Absolutely. Would I say that, you know, in my initial reaction was pretty like, yeah, because that was a big, 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 big project, big national project. But what I know and what I'm aware of is that we put down the imprint that really served low-income communities in a really profound way and that was game-changing. So sometimes you have to know when to step back, right, and just say, I set the imprint down. And it's time to move on to the next thing.
It's a mature way of looking at it. I dig that. Last person.
It didn't. It didn't. It didn't feel. It didn't feel so mature at the time. But I've come to that. I didn't feel so mature at the time.
I definitely understand that. The last person to dial in, caller at 1184. Did you have a quick question for Ms. Conway? Caller at 1184.
Yeah, thank you. Good evening. Greetings.
Hi.
And, greetings, Ms. Conway. What's your burning desire?
Well, I love that question. Thank you. My burning desire is to awaken Black people to their own power and potential in ways that they'd never dreamed possible. I think to do that, you know, one of the things that I learned about my daddy and the revolution from my daddy is the revolution's got to be funded. That's the truth. Revolution's got to be funded. So, you know, and you look at like what Claude Anderson talks about in Powernomics, he talks about when you're talking about building an economy, which we have an economy, it's $1.1 trillion, all the money goes out of our economy and goes, it bounces once in our community and changes hands, and then the money leaves our community. So it's like if somebody goes and gets their paycheck from their employer and then turns around and goes and spends that money at Walmart, it bounces once in our community, and then it leaves. In the Jewish community, it bounces 17 times before it leaves the Jewish community. And so because of that, other cultures can buy politicians and cops and the court process. They fund all of that to their advantage, and that's why we're seeing what we're seeing out here in terms of stop and frisk and all that stuff. But I'm not saying that, I'm just saying that I want to see us step up and be able to level the playing field. Not necessarily play on their terms, because I believe that if we got clear about how to, every game that we enter into, we end up dominating. We've got to get this economic independent self-sufficiency thing down and stop bleeding all of our resources and human capital out into other cultures and benefiting everybody else so that they can then turn around and use that against us. We have got to stop that bloodletting. And so, to me, so the consciousness that it takes to do that and be that, that's my burning desire, is to see that fulfilled. It will not happen in my lifetime, but that's my burning desire.
It will not or will. It will not or will.
Yeah.
You say it will or will not?
It will not happen in my lifetime.
What will not happen in your lifetime?
That Black people get together and coalesce as a spiritual economic force to be reckoned with. I think that will take generations.
Okay. If that's what you think or expect, but anything is possible, though, you know?
It is possible. We'd have to show up differently. And so one of the ways that I've done to put that in place is by building an army of Black coaches that know how to coach Black people, right? If we can begin to at least dismantle some of the psychological wounds that people are experiencing. So that's why I built Black coaches as a force.
You really do have your subject matter really, 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 really vivid and down packed, you know, because I've studied this information that where you're coming from, from a lot of different angles, and you're one of the few people that I've ever heard speak about it, and where you can tell that the person is very ingrained with the information and built up with the information, and have a host of references inside of themselves for the information, you know.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I take that as a compliment. That's an interesting point. Yes, I got a lot. I probably have 100 more spiritual, transformational. I mean, business. That's a lot of pieces together that I don't. I think a fairly unique way. But you're right. Thank you. I've been a huge student of a lot of modalities, all pointed at how to begin to direct these to empower our community. So thank you. Thank you. I really received that.
Yeah, and I think what makes it powerful is when you receive that vision where all of this different so-called study is cross-referenced, and you really do see the connectedness of it all. That it builds a conviction factor a thousandfold, you know?
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. So that's what happens. I find when I work with people or just in my own experience, it's like that when you open up, when you clear enough limitations, the vision just begins to download into you, like from source. It just begins to download, right? And then you start to follow the clues that are downloading into you. And so you find now sort of one piece of the puzzle. So that's been my journey, is to just kind of incorporate and have the capacity to kind of gather up the different technologies that I think would be the most effective and potent. Like Yamla Van Zant she's a friend of mine, and she's on the Black Mastery program, and she says, you just channel technologies, don't you? Like, you just sit down, and then you go, I want that, and it just arrives in your space. And that's really the truth. That's been my gift in the world, is that I'm a kind of an open conduit for a lot of things to come in and then to be able to synthesize them and use that to support other people. So thank you. Thank you for witnessing that.
Well, we've been dancing
like this
all night. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I'll look into your material.
Thank you.
Appreciate that, 1184. Final person actually just wrote in, I guess, final question from our audience. They wanted to know, I guess, they were looking at your website and they saw where you said that the problem is not white people. The problem is in your mind. And they just wanted to make sure they got a clear explanation of that before you exit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question. Because if we deprogrammed and got our heads on straight and really knew who we were, then I think game over. So that's not to say that we are not under assault by the dominant culture. But the assault is only meaningful because we have forgotten who we are. That's why it's meaningful. It's because we have forgotten who we are, and we're so confused that we not only have internalized their racism against us, and like I talk in the Black paper about internalized oppression, we've internalized so much of that, and we operate from so much of that. I think that when we get clear about that, game over. It's not impossible to beat them at their game. But we can't do that. There is a mindset that we have to begin to adopt, I think, to create that and to cause that.
Oh, I totally agree. I guess they're saying if there is massive white resistance to Black people developing that mindset and getting clear, that would seem to suggest to them that the problem is white people.
Well, the thing is that they, you know, the mind is actually the last frontier. It's the last frontier after information and technology. It's really the last frontier. It's still the thing that you can choose to have control over. right? If you're aware of the ways that you've been programmed, if you're aware of what you're up against from the standpoint of psychological warfare, you know, you still have dominion over your mind. It's the last frontier. So their reaction to how you deal with your own psyche, that's not any of my, I don't know if I care. It's up to us to get back, to get control back of our own minds and mindsets and sensibilities. They're not going to do it for us. We're the only ones that can choose that. We're on notice. We're on notice that there will be nothing forthcoming. Right, so we have to do that for ourselves. We don't do that at our own peril, and we have to, fair or not. It's not fair, but it's what we're going to have to do.
I definitely do not expect white people to change any changes that are going to be made.
So we have to.
Absolutely. Again, you can visit the website, her personal website, veronicaconway.com. Should be linked in the description if you're listening at Black Talk Radio Network. Again, it is veronicaconway.com. And then the program for Black Mastery, that is at www.blackmastery.com. And I'll put that on my Facebook page so it'll be easy for folks to locate.
Or the black paper. They can put the black paper because I'm going to update that because it's about 5 years old, so I'll be 6 years old now. I'll be updating that soon. So if you get on the list at blackmastery.com, at theblackpaper.com, then when that all updates, then you'll get notified about that.
All right, on. And that's the blackpaper.com. Very easy to remember.
Yes.
Blackpaper.com. Thoroughly enjoyed having you on the program.
I enjoyed it too.
Wish you immense and continued success and for all of the black clients that you work with as well. And also am hoping that your father is released sometime very, very soon. Wish you tons of success with your legal endeavors. And I hope that there is massive compensation for his mistreatment that he gets in addition to being able to walk out someday soon.
Yeah, me too. Thank you.
For sure. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and we'll definitely be in touch. Just continue your excellent efforts, and hopefully listeners will check out the material.
Thank you. Take good care.
You too.
Okay. Good night.
Good evening. Context of white supremacy. Again, Ms. Conway, I think courtesy of Universal Jones. I could be in error. Listeners have checked me before when I made a mistake about who recommended a guest or whatever, if it's a concept or a book that we did. But I think that was Universal Jones, unless I am mistaken. But, yes, visit the websites, veronicaconway.com, theblackpaper.com, blackmastery.com. Check out the material. See if it's of constructive value. You can support a black entrepreneur. I'll take a quick commercial break, then if we have anything folks need to get in before we wrap up. I was reminded the broadcast that we did many, 4 years ago. It's not that long. The broadcast that we did 4 years ago with Dr. Kwabena Ashanti, where he was talking about when you brain trash someone and the state that we're in, being confused about what's happening. And a point that I thought was important that he raised was that you cannot successfully program brain trash someone if they know that they've been programmed. He said that a core component of programming someone is that they are not aware that they have been programmed, and that just our exchange today reminded me of that. I think that is very important. The job that white people have done to us, the success of it is that we are not even aware of the damage that has been done. That tends to happen late, if at all, for many of the victims. We will take a quick commercial break. I will include a news segment because we started the program. I asked Ms. Conway about President Obama and the legislation that got passed today for LGBTQ folks, mostly white people, I suspect. This was like a few hours ago. This happened a few hours before we went live, so I don't know if people saw it. If you haven't had a chance to look at the news or read the paper or whatever the case may be on the day, I wanted to include this news segment because I got such a hearty laugh out of it. You all might find it amusing as well, although racism, white supremacy is definitely no joke. We will take a quick commercial break, and I'll include the news segment after we do the commercial. So commercial, news segment, and then if folks have anything brief that they want to add in before we conclude things, we'll make time for that as well. Invest if you think the broadcast is constructive, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. PayPal is in the top right corner. Invest if you have gotten anything constructive. If you are not a fan of PayPal, you can drop me an email and we can get a mailing address for you as well. Thanks to all of the folks who have invested over the years and kept us rolling for 5+ years. You can also support by sharing links to the program. Put it on Facebook, Twitter, if you have any other social media sites to help get the content out to other non-white people. Quick commercial, and we'll be right back. Context of white supremacy.
RacismDaily.com, your number one source for global news reports on race, racism, and overt actions of white supremacy. From Asia to the Americas to Europe to Australia to Africa, racism is not a thing of the past. It is our current reality. Be informed. Be globally informed. You should be the first to know. RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com. Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Do you need a one-stop shop for all of your multimedia needs? Triumphant Multimedia is a skilled team of professionals with a passion for great marketing and chic design. Our specialties include consulting, brand development, copywriting, and creative graphic design. That's second to none. We also offer photography, photo retouching, videography, and video editing. At Triumphant Multimedia, our goal is to provide highly effective creative solutions built to suit any individual need or budget. Give us a call at 678-732-8067 or check us out online at trimultimedia.com.
Everyone, welcome. This is Justice with the Cows Radio program. If you want to learn about, understand, and counter racism, white supremacy, be sure not to miss a Cows episode. We keep them jammed, packed with constructive information to sharpen your use of words to help eliminate the system of racism, white supremacy, ASAP. Also, to be able to invest in my counter racist efforts, co-hosting the Cows Radio program, please visit my blog, justdojusticetoday.blogspot.com.
you're just saying just buckets and buckets of work.
I got an uncle real crazy. My Uncle B, 55 years old, hates white people, married to a white lady. And he sit around going, you know, these crackers ain't shit, except for Susan. And he tried to explain the whole thing to me one day, say, yeah, I got a white wife, I love her, she love me, that's all that matter. But I tell you this, if the revolution ever come, I'll kill her first. Just to show these crackers I mean business. Motherfucker cracker ass, motherfucker cracker. Shit cracker motherfucker. What? Hey, hi, honey. Motherfucker cracker, I'll kill my cracker kid too.
President Obama signed an executive order today giving new employment protections to gay and transgender people, and this is for people who work for the government. NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson reports that the move comes after years of pressure from LGBT activists.
At the White House today, President Obama signed the order saying, "We're on the right side of history." He said it was time to address this injustice for every American.
Millions of our fellow citizens wake up and go to work with the awareness that they could lose their job, not because of anything they do or fail to do, but because of who they are. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. And that's wrong. We're here to do what we can to make it right, to bend that arc of justice just a little bit in a better direction.
Just a little bit, because the president's order only applies to people who work in the government or for federal contractors. But still, the human rights campaign's Fred Sains said it was a historic step.
Today's action will no doubt cement his legacy as by far the friendliest president in our history towards LGBT equality.
The next step, the president told his audience of activists, was to pass the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA. ENDA passed the Senate by a big 64-32 majority, but it has not been passed by the House of Representatives.
But I'm going to do what I can with the authority I have to act. The rest of you, of course, need to keep putting pressure on Congress to pass federal legislation that resolves this problem once and for all.
Amen.
Amen. Amen. Got the amen corner here. Well.
ENDA would apply to all U.S. workplaces. The order the president signed today applies to 28 million workers. That's a lot, but only one-fifth of the U.S. workforce. It shows that while the president can act on his own, executive orders have limited impact compared to legislation passed by Congress. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
Oh, man, I wouldn't put my woo sound effect in. I just listened to the report like, wow, this is... It's warfare and white people clowning all in one. What is going on? Woo! Anyway, I went from stunned to just, you know, laughing at the absurdity of it all at the end of it. I went from the beginning just being repulsed and stunned. I do not think you have white gay people, white lesbians, white transgender, white queer, or any other letters that they want to add on. I don't think any of these people are going to work in fear that they're going to lose their job because they are gay, queer, lesbian, ... I just call flat out, that is not true. It is a total lie, and I think that that is a part of the white supremacist campaign to further push confusion, since that's what we've been talking about, confusion, psychological warfare that was also brought out. I think that is just another aspect of it. And I especially think that getting all of this gay rights passed with President Obama's name on it, so it is black. I've been saying that, to keep black and gay in close proximity. I don't know if it was in that report or one of the other ones I heard, because they all got jumbled together, but they said President Obama is by far the friendliest ally to gay rights that we ever had in the White House. And I go back to that, the picture in Newsweek. Somebody got kind of uppity about it and saying, well, you are talking crazy, saying that they're trying to make black people the face of gay rights. And I said, well, let's Laverne Cox. Gay is the New Black. How many documentaries have they released in the last 5 years where it is centered on black people and homophobia, not just here in the United States, because they got one that just came out on PBS, The New Black, where that's what it's all about, black people being homophobes. They got one that came out about Jamaica. They got one that came out about Uganda. I can go and get you all the titles for these different films so that you can check them out. You had the Newsweek cover with President Obama on the front page, the gay president. That was the title of it, and it had a rainbow halo over his head. I could go even further. We had some of our listeners who even added to the list in terms of them saying that Serena Williams, she's really a man, and all these other comments. Jason Collins, front page of Sports Illustrated last year, the gay athlete, and the controversy that happened today, the same day that this legislation gets passed, Tony Dungy, who's a black former black NFL head coach. I think he was the first black NFL coach to win a Super Bowl. I could be in error about that, but I know he did win a Super Bowl. He said that if he were still coaching a team, he would not have drafted Michael Sam, black gay athlete. He wouldn't have drafted him because of all the distractions around that and all the extra media attention. It just would have diverted from them being focused on what they're trying to do as a football team. White people flipped out. They was trending all day long on Twitter. Let me see if it's still trending. It stopped. He was trending all day long. It just up until very recent. I mean, like within the last hour, Tony Dungy was trending all day long, where people were calling him all kinds of homophobes and, oh my Lord, I can't believe he said this, and what a disgrace, and if anyone should know better, it should be you, and blah, 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 all day long, right in concert with them having President Obama come out and sign this legislation. All of that is not coincidence. All of that, in my opinion, is coordinated, synchronized racism, white supremacy, and pushing their agenda in Area 8, sexual confusion. I could be in error. I would encourage anyone to think about it. But in terms of black people being the face, and it's so wild because they have black people as the face of gay rights with all these individuals, and they have black people as the face of being homophobes. Which is typical of racist woman and racist man. They cover their bases. Anywho, I will encourage folks, this is totally unrelated, I will encourage folks to be mindful. The trial of Renisha McBride started today up in Michigan. Renisha McBride, she's a 19-year-old black female who was shot and killed, memory serves, in October of 2013. Ted Wafer, racist suspect, shot and killed her on his porch. That started today. I said, this reminds me of last, so this is why I don't really get that excited about any of these events, whether it's Eric Garner in New York or this event. I mean, this stuff happens every day. This is what you should expect under the system of racism, white supremacy, in my view, when you are constantly responding emotionally to all of these events, that you can kind of get worn out or just in a state where you are not responding adequately as a soldier. If you are a soldier in battle, people are dying around you all the time. You don't have a conniption every time someone dies. Not that that should be minimized, but this is what that racism is war. Racism is war. That is what is being waged against black people, especially non-white people worldwide. But be mindful, definitely. I hope folks, particularly listeners in the Michigan area, be mindful. I will be paying attention. It sounds just so familiar. I feel like we were in this exact spot last summer. Same thing, black person, black teenager, shot and killed unjustly, and this ends up being racial theater for the summer. What's going to happen? Anywho, any other quick tidbits I had to get before by checking in to see if the listeners had anything. This is not, and I'm not encouraging anyone to watch the film. Before I forget, listeners, added a city. If you are in the Columbus, Ohio area, and you are interested, you want to know if there are other listeners in that area or just folks who are less confused about racism and would like to try to network, meet up with other Black people, non-white people who are less confused. Columbus, Ohio area has been added to the map. So now we have Bay Area, Washington, D.C., New York City area. So we have four cities or locales. If you're in those spots and you would like to hook up, network, let me stop saying hook up, network with other Black people, victims of racism, you can drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, and I will forward the information. I think some people have already sent out a few messages or what have you and should be trying to meet up and see if they have constructive dialogue. Hopefully we'll get good reports back. But Columbus, Ohio has been added. I am not encouraging anyone to watch the footage, the film. The only reason I watched it is because the title caught my eye as I was whizzing by online. It's a film called The Human Race. And just that title, that's why it stood out to me. I tend to be hypersensitive about the term race or racism or whatever the case may be. The short and tall of it, there is a race. These people have been randomly snatched. I think it's 80 of them. I could be mistaken, but it's something under 100. These people have been randomly snatched, and they are ordered to run. And they have to run and keep running. If they refuse to run, they will be killed. If you are lapped twice, you will be killed. And if you step off of the path where you're supposed to be running, if you step off onto the grass or into the other restricted area, you will be killed. Those are the rules. And they just give out the rules and you're off. You're supposed to start racing. And I'm watching this like, okay, racism is going to be that. I've told that people that before. People have asked me about films to watch for racism. I'm picking my 10 based on my criteria about films that reveal what it means to be white, can offer great lessons on the system of racism, white supremacy. But if you're just looking for films with racism, you can pick anything because I don't think I've ever seen a film that did not in some way, shape, or form have racist white supremacist programming in it. In fact, when I first started all this back in 2007, when the program started, that was one of the things that we would do. We would just randomly pick films because it really doesn't matter what you're watching. It's going to be there. The racism is going to be there at any rate. So I'm watching this film, and the first thing that jumps out to me is there are very few Black people in this quote unquote race. There are a few of them in there, but there are very few. And the people that you're following, the people that they have you connected to emotionally are all white, most of them white women, but all white. They're rolling along in this race, and they tell you that there are safe spots where you can stop, you can rest, and you will not be killed. A group of people get to this safe spot, and they say, hey, wait a minute. If we can just get all of the people that they have, you know, got together in this, and they don't explain it, all the people that have been assembled for this race, if we can just get them all together to stop in a safe spot, nobody will be killed, nobody will be lapped, and then we can try to figure out, you know, what has happened, what we're going to do, all of that. We can just get to the safe spot and stop. So they try to do that, but it breaks down. People break out, and they cannot get or they cannot coordinate their efforts. And what stood out to me, the brutality, the pathology of white people, I immediately, like as soon as this starts, I'm thinking, yeah, they should just get to a safe spot and stop so they can try and think and figure out what's happening as opposed to everybody just trying to run and run and run and run and run and you don't really know what's going on. As opposed to that, you have large numbers of white people who just stop and say, hey, we can just have fun killing people. That'll increase our chances of winning. and we have fun killing anyway. So you just have large numbers of white people, all white people, I might add, who just start killing people and having a grand old time doing it, laughing up and down like nothing could be more fun. And it reminded me of what Dr. Welsing said when she was talking about Elliot Rodger and his father being with the Hunger Games, a film, in my opinion, celebrating children killing children. She said that is these type of environment. White supremacy necessitates killing large numbers of people, especially black people. Renisha McBride, Eric Garner, Jonathan Farrell, Miriam Carey, Trayvon Martin, blah, 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 blah. Going to happen. You can just write that down. In that sort of environment, killing has got to be normal, especially killing of black people, has got to be normalized. That's got to be, you know, whatever, ho-hum, having a grand old time, because there's going to be large amounts of that happening every day. So the white people are having a butt. They're doing exactly that, having a grand old time killing people. Now, there are a few black people in this film, not very many, there are a few. One of them is a black female, a pregnant black female. Obviously, she's not going to be able to run very fast to keep up with anybody. Obviously, she gets to a point where she can't run anymore. She's seated. I already told you, if you get lapped twice, you're killed. Individual, he might be white, I'm not sure. He was, if I had to guess, maybe Brazilian, Spanish, not really sure. Definitely not a black person. Maybe he is accepted as white, I don't know. At any rate, he laps her, and he knows that he's going to lap her for the second time, but he's whatever, I don't care. You're about to be lapped, and peace out. And it's really even more despicable than what I'm saying, because he stops and acts like he's going to be friends with her for a little while and rubs her pregnant. She's like way pregnant, like 8 months pregnant. He rubs her belly and everything. He's like, yeah, well, I'm lapping you too. Peace. And he runs out. So they killed this pregnant black female. Now, that was enough for me at that point to be like, you know, I really did not need to see this. You know, like this is the type of entertainment that we get under the system of racism, white supremacy all day long. I can't even imagine what my thought process would have been if I had been watching this when I was more confused about racism, the implications that I would have thought seeing something like that happen while Renisha McBride's trial started today. At any rate, so they kill this black female, and they don't just kill the black female. They kill her, and they make sure that they kill the child in her womb as well, right? So they make all this really graphic. So then this other group of white people who've been just having a grand old time killing people, they come by and they're joking like, oh, man, I just stepped on a black child. And they go off and keep killing people. And I'm just like, wow, like this is the mind of racist women and racist men. And again, I'm not encouraging anyone to watch this film. It wasn't, you know, you don't even need to see it. There you go, spoiler alert. A white person wins the race. If anything, it was interesting because it was a deaf white woman and a white man who had a leg amputated. He was a soldier. They ended up being the last two people there, which to me tells you all you need to know about the system of racism, white supremacy. When they start talking about ableism and everything else, if you're white and crippled, if you're white and deaf, if you're white and you have Down syndrome, if you're white and a midget, if you're white and you are lesbian, transgender, gay, one finger, no fingers, white is white is white is white. You are on the white army. There are expectations that go with that. And it's my experience that white people are not ignorant. They're not blonde. They're not in denial. They overstand what that means to be white and to be a part of that army. I could be in error, but I don't think so. If I traumatized anyone with the film, hey, you didn't even watch it. I watched it unknowingly. So, you know, my bad. But I mean, that's what we got. That's what we got. Keep that in mind. When anyone is confused about Eric Garner and Renisha McBride and why these situations keep happening, there you go. You're talking to people who make movies about killing, blowing up a pregnant black female. Anywho, do I have any other tidbits? Wanted to make sure I got out. There were some other news bits, but I'll save it for this weekend. If anybody had anything they were going to add before we wrap things up, I will check the lines. hopefully we will not be here for the full 3 hours. If anybody had a brief, quick comment, the folks that dialed in, the line should be open.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Not to bash another victim, it's just that I disagreed with the guest on several points of interest. And, you know, I thought that some of her material was constructive, but, you know, it seems like if you have got a kid that's going to school and he's getting beat up by bullies, then you tell him to just ignore the lumps on your head. Yeah. Ignore the vicious verbal attacks, and that will empower you, and you can get through this year and several years of schooling and come out unscathed. I don't think that that's being realistic. And it seems as though she was contradictory, because you're supposed to call a situation exactly what it is. I mean, I have lived my entire life, and I would hate to think that I was going to be going out of this life just as confused and backwards as I was when I came in. So, I mean, not that the system probably wouldn't work, but you'd have to fool yourself, and you would have to lie to yourself is a great injustice. And I just think when a young black person gives an essay or a dissertation or whatever on white privilege, when it's white people that can best tell you what white privilege is, I don't think that that is a indication that that young black person is conscious, black conscious. You know, there was a few other things, you know, that she mentioned that, you know, I wasn't in agreement with, but basically, it's not to put her down, but, and it's not to say that, you know, some of her strategies and tactics will not work, but the part about lying to yourself, and she herself said that she was victimized even at 7 years old, and then to not call yourself a victim when you were victimized even earlier than a lot of victims that identify as victims. And you're a victim yourself if you don't realize the situation that you're in. And so I'll just mute my line on that. Thanks.
Yeah, it's been my, I don't know, maybe I just haven't been around enough black people or the correct black people, but most of the black, and I told her this, most of the black people that I'm in contact with, they do not think of themselves as victims. And I think she agreed when I said that. She said that was part of the problem. But it's been my experience. I do not see large numbers, cornucopia of black people saying, yes, I'm a victim. And, you know, I'm just going to sit in the corner and call myself. I do not see that. I see black people just going around and saying, I can do anything. I asked the person on the program yesterday, are you scared of white people? He said, absolutely not. I'm not afraid of anybody. That's standard response that I get from people. So I don't know. I'm of the opinion, as you said, about just being truthful. For me, saying that you're a victim does not mean that all is hopeless and that nothing can be done. If anything, it is liberating for me, because I think for a lot of black people, they feel as though they have been shortchanged, as though they have not accomplished all that they could, all that they would like to. And they think it's something wrong with them, that they personally are defective in some way, that they're not smart enough. I think in her literature, she says that's one of the problems that she comes in contact with, that Black people thinking that they're not smart enough, or that they're not qualified, or they're not capable, or they're not attractive. For me, saying, oh, I'm a victim. For me, it is something has been done to me. Something is still being done to me where I am being harmed so that I cannot accomplish all the things that I would like to do. Not that that means, oh, lay down, don't try. It just means, oh, okay, I understand. White people are working so that I am not going to be able to accomplish things. Got it. That will need to be factored in when I go out to accomplish things to get things done. That will need to be factored in that white people are aggressively working against you, particularly if you're a Black person and you're trying to do something constructive, you are going to get massive opposition. And I think there are, I mean, too many numerous examples. But as I said, I'm accustomed to that. I get that from lots of people. I think Mr. Fuller has talked about that as well, where Black people, I don't think of myself as a victim. I don't consider myself a victim. I don't argue and dispute people over that. Generally, I just wait for them to come back down the road, whether it's a day or 5 years, to say, man, I have been mistreated. And that resolves itself. But yeah. Anywho, anybody else have anything they were going to comment on?
Hi there. I think that's a bit of a confusing topic that you guys are talking about, because it's something I struggle with personally. And because I continually recognize the importance of being straight up. Like, for instance, Gus, if you weren't always so straight up about things, it would probably be very hard for me to get over some of these concepts. Like, it would be very hard for me to actually genuinely understand the fact that white people in general are gonna do things to hurt me and stuff like that. But I feel like for me the confusion lies in that I understand what she's saying, talking about being victimized instead of being a victim. But I think it entirely depends on the person. But I understand why she says that, because, you know, instead of calling herself a victim all the time, she's not subconsciously limiting herself. Like, what she's talking about is, like, she'll have, like, somebody will call in and they'll have like, a goal that they just can't get to because they don't believe they can do it, really, deep down inside. And, I don't know. To me, I think that white supremacy is probably set up in ways that it is very paradoxical for us to try and unravel the tangled mess that, you know, these associations are that we have with associations with certain things and blah, blah, blah. I'm sorry if I'm not making much sense. But I just wanted to say that I think it's a balance that maybe some people need to think about, consider striking a balance between understanding that you are victimized and will be victimized on a daily basis, but also trying to think of things in ways that aren't going to limit you in the future, and so that you still feel like you can go out there. But it's funny when you said you wait for them to call back. That's really funny, because I feel like I've done that exact same thing. I've been like, one day I've been like, oh, I don't know what these guys are talking about. And then, like, I always come back to the cows. Anyways, thank you. Sorry if that was confusing.
Got it. I was going to bring that up as well. It's been my experience. White people don't seem to have a problem referencing themselves as victims. I've been pointing that out, I think, over the last year as well. It just seems to be an issue when Black people say that I am a victim of racism. White people jump up and say that they're victims all the time. Even when they're not victims, they will jump up and say that they're victims all the time. But anywho, anybody else have a comment they wanted to make in before we wrap things up?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Peace to everybody on the line. Hotel. I just wanted to kind of speak on the fact that, you know, I kind of heard from a friend who listens that the person was saying kind of like, hey, you know, we need to stop blaming stuff on white people and stuff like that, and or Europeans, to be more specific. And, you know, I find that, you know, a lot of the rhetoric that comes across to us as, you know, black people and non-whites in the system of racism, white supremacy, which I consider to be involuntary servitude, I mean, a lot of these people who come out in some ways, if they're not polished and refined on the subject or taking it seriously, it seems like they inadvertent agents, you know, against what we want to do here is, you know, replace the system of racism, white supremacy with justice. But it's like they want to take your main argument away. I look at it like being a part of a criminal trial or a civil trial. And if I'm trying to prove my case, you know, it's like majority of these people and these white supremacists or whoever may take these positions, it's like they forget that we still have things like the CIA and the FBI and all of these propaganda machines, which it's not necessarily, to me, in my view, it's not necessarily the FBI or the CIA or the government that I'm against. I'm just against the Europeans that are in the government and running these particular organizations, because when they put these rhetorics out there like that, it'll cause a big conversation about, you know, not really still focusing on black people replacing the system of justice with race. I mean, replacing the system of racism, white supremacy with justice to me. And I just, you know, when I hear like non-whites or even Europeans say stuff like that, I just look at it as an attack. And under the system of racism, white supremacy, I not only look at the KKK as a terrorist organization, I also look at the European Freemasons as a terrorist organization that's a part of that racism, white supremacy that helps maintain that system. And so when I use that formula, when I hear some of these stories, I look at it as it being crafted and being molded by somebody on the other end with, you know, a little bit more ability than we may give racism, white supremacy. I feel like they try to make us think that the KKK is like the highest degree of racism. But in actuality, it would be the European Freemasons who are in every city and have buildings and have sworn secrets and concealed things that have exactly to do with black people and have exactly to do to, you know, with non-white people and what we are talking about. And so I think that the more of us who start to see that and willing to make that connection, it'll start to help us, because, you know, a lot of this stuff we shouldn't even really still keep talking about. We know that white people is the blame, you know, and that they are the problem. And it's just like, you know, like this show is all dedicated to, you know, it's a lot of things that they do that we can see and we can hear and we know that are wrong. But because they got so many propaganda machines in place, whether it be your religion or how you look at even all the videos that they put out about the Illuminati over the last couple of years, that was to make people quiet on speaking out against what they do, because they want to put a fear element into the movement and what we're talking about, in my observation. Because once you say that like that, I mean, you sound so smart. I mean, hey, we know racism, white supremacy going on. We know that the KKK is a fundamental institution in that. And you can also say that the European Freemasons would be right along with them. And those people are just as dangerous as the Ku Klux Klan members, because they don't have to lynch you off the tree right then and there or be aggressive towards you. They could go join and be the police. They could be a judge. They could be a doctor, you know. And I just find that we take our minds off of that so much as people in this struggle, which we should not. because that'll help us get out if we could just focus on that and see that these people are totally against us and that we should be making moves daily to get ourselves out the system and to kind of help other non-white people. And I have meant no anti-blackness in my statements. So I mute my line and, you know, peace.
Right on. Yeah, I think that definitely is a major tactic that racists are doing and trying to make us think. When you think of a racist white supremacist, you just think of some goofy Klan person, as opposed to, as I've said consistently, you should just think of the white person that lives next door to you. They're probably doing things every day that help maintain, refine, expand the system of white supremacy, whether it's what they're doing with regards to making sure that there are not too many or maybe even no black people who are allowed to live in that particular area, what they do with their finances. Dr. Cambon talks about it all the time with economics. What are they doing with their finances to make sure that black people are not well off financially and having their own businesses or whatever else black people want to do? Just think of the white person that you go to school with, that you go to work with, that you live next door to. Those white people right there are probably doing way more damage with regards to upholding, maintaining the system of white supremacy than some goofy, crude caricature of a Klan person. Those everyday individual white people are doing all kinds of stuff. The white people that go to work at the bank, they are doing major work, and they are not in the Klan. They would never call a black person nigger publicly or anything else. So that's definitely one thing that I make an effort to emphasize all the time. It's just, what does it mean to be a white person? You should think, suspect each individual white person is probably in many ways contributing to that system. I would, at least for me, I do not reference other non-white people as agents. That word gets used. I make a habit of not doing, number one, just because it's name calling, and I think we should try to get out of the habit of name calling other non-white people and name call, just calling someone something that they do not call themselves. That's, in my view, name calling, particularly with that Asian thing, because that gets all of the people that are writing right now saying that Gus needs to apologize because I called a black person an agent. And I mean, that is absurd and inaccurate. That's just not language that I use. I don't get into any of that. And I can reference Dr. Cambon again, KamalCambon.org, where he says, if you are a victim of white supremacy, you are an agent, period. Everybody. And he included himself in that. If you are subject to white people in any area of people activity where you have to go to them and get authorization, get their permission to do anything, you are an agent. That was his definition, and I think that's accurate, and I avoid all that because I've seen where that can be end up being a big distraction as well for non-white people, victims of racism. But that's just my suggestion. I could be in error. I was looking at the news. I would, again, encourage check the news, local, national, global, every day. I was checking the news because I brought up Clive and Bundy today, the militia folks out in the desert. And I said, now, if black people did that, there would be arrests. They would have been tased, billy clubbed. You might have had some Eric Garners out in the desert if that had been black people instead of Clive and Bundy and his white thugs. Now, in Detroit, how we've also been talking about the white people who had been blocking the buses where they had those what they call migrant children out in Marietta, California. They were blocking the buses, right? We talked about that. I said the same thing. If black people had done that, these were Homeland Security officials as well, where white people were out blocking these buses. I said, now, if black people had done that, same thing. Pepper spray, tased, billy club, bang, bang, you know, blood would have been rolling in the street. Move organization, they would have bombed and burned down the whole block. Now, in Detroit, where I said this has been a failure for Gus, where I haven't really covered this as much on the program, the water shortage in Detroit, because that's impacting a lot of black people. This is on Al Jazeera, where they have Detroit activists block trucks sent to shut off water. Now, you already can guess what's going to happen with this one, since they're probably black people out in the street. As Detroit's water provider continues to carry out its plan to turn off the taps of tens of thousands of non-paying customers across the city, activists are resorting to civil disobedience in an attempt to stop what they call a human rights violation. Some 50 demonstrators on Thursday held a protest outside the offices of Humrich, a company contracted by Detroit Water and Sewage Department to stop the flow to residences at least 2 months past due on their accounts. At least nine of the activists were arrested by Detroit police and charged with disorderly conduct when they temporarily blocked trucks from leaving the company's parking lot. They were released on bail hours later. While the protest was relatively small, activists say it's a sign of things to come if DWSD continues shutting off water lines. The activists say that in a city with a poverty rate of 44% and where water bills are higher than in much of the country, Detroit should work out a solution with poor residents instead of leaving them dry. Otherwise, they say they'll have no choice but to take to the streets. I will stop there. It does go on with more details, but the article is Detroit activists block trucks sent to shut off water. And they conveniently have a black enforcement official next to a police vehicle where they got apparently some of these protesters in the back of the car. Looks like they're going off to be incarcerated or whatever the case may be. But this is on AlJazeera.com where they're reporting on this. As I said, you can contrast this either or, Clive and Bundy, or you can take the Murrieta incident. And I think that's not the only one where they were even saying that there were white whistleblowers who were with Homeland Security or some of these other detention agencies that are busing these quote-unquote immigrant children around, where they were calling and letting these white protesters know where the buses were going to be so that then they could go out and protest and block these buses in the street. Now, I haven't seen any footage where any of these folks have been beaten, arrested, tased, none. But I suspect probably a good portion of black people, I'm sure there are white people too from what I've seen, there were white people out protesting in Detroit as well, but I definitely saw black, way more black and non-white people than what I saw at Clive and Bundy's establishment or Murrieta, California. At any rate, when these folks go out to try to block people from cutting off water, it is immediately time to get the handcuffs out. That right there, another great illustration of white supremacy, racism. And in my view, that would be more evidence that the problem is white people. I could be in error. We will be back on Wednesday. We'll have a black graduate student, Robert Reese, Duke University, North Carolina. He'll be on the program. We'll hear his views on racism. Also, I hope he has been keeping up with the name change that happened to the dorm down in Duke. That was earlier this month. It was named after a white supremacist governor. And they had to fuss and scrap and fight, but they finally agreed to change the name this coming school year. We can hear about that as well as some of the material that he has written on. Should be same program time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Briefly before we exit, the study session book club, we're doing I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, Dr. Maya Angelou. This Friday is our second installment. We just got started last week. If you missed out, it's in the archives. As I said, I didn't read this book in school. I know this book is very, very popular. And I suspect a lot of our listeners probably read this in school. I don't know how this book is discussed in school. Just from the first session, it was fascinating to me how a book like this would be talked about, what would be said about it, particularly if you have a white teacher, what they would say about this book in class. If you read this book in school, I would definitely appreciate folks chiming in to share what that discussion sounded like, what an A-plus paper, if you had to write on this book, what an A-plus book report would sound like under the racist, white supremacist academic systems that are set up. I'm just very intrigued based on what I've seen so far and what I know is to be coming in the book. One person found a report that a white professor, literary professor, wrote about this book. It's on my Facebook page. You can check it out. I emailed her, and she said she'd be down to come on the program. So we will have further detail in the future, hearing input from what white people think about this book. But that's I mean, that's in the forefront of my mind as we go through this text. Why is this book so popular with white people? Because I just see tons of white people who rave, love this book, and make sure that many, many people read this book in school. So that definitely, I'm looking forward to that as we continue through the book. You can keep that in mind. And as I said, if you read this in class, definitely, at college level, high school, wherever, chime in, let me know what the discussion sounded like, particularly if you had a white instructor who was upfront leading the dialogue on this book. We will be back on Wednesday. Hopefully the program was of some constructive value. Hopefully you were able to get something. Like I said, I don't get bogged down in the whole victim thing. I've already made my conclusion about where I stand on that. I know a lot of people don't agree, and that's fine too. Rock and roll. The main point is to replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Creator, we ask that you help all of us remain focused on the problem. Racist woman, racist child, racist man. Help us use our skills, time, energy, currency in the most efficient manner possible to bring about constructive results for ourselves and those non-white people that we care about. Help us remain suspicious of every single individual who is classified, accepted as white. No exceptions, no white friends. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Context of white supremacy, signing out. Since we do have Chris Rock in the program, I am reminded Chris Rock did say, if you do a film project on racism, white supremacy, I think he said civil rights, but that's basically racism, white supremacy, and white people like it, you probably didn't do a good job. Context of white supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.